It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
What is with this company's obsession with ninjas?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Too many ninjas.
You haven't been beat up properly.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
This is episode 669 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, September 13, 2020. I am the Solo Monster. AEW climbs back over a million viewers. Miro makes his debut. Ivar gets hurt on Raw, and it sounds like it could be serious. Ryback is an idiot. So many things to get into here this week, and I thank you all for choosing me for your weekly wrestling coverage. I hope you'll choose Audible. Hope you'll choose to support our sponsors, audible.com. A lot of free wrestling books that you can choose from. You get to pick one. As part of your 30-day trial of the Audible service, you can give it a sample. You get one free book of your choice that you get to keep no matter what. audibletrial.com/solomonster. That does not happen unless you use our link. So be sure to punch that in the right way. audibletrial.com/solomonster. I've been told that Amazon Prime members could get up to two free books. So go ahead and use our link. And every time you do, you support the podcast. And who doesn't want something for free? So audibletrial.com/solomonster. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may join the PayPal posse. Go to thesolomonster.com. You'll see the button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. There is no Patreon right now. There is no nothing else. It's just that button has been there for years. And it is completely up to you if you want to show your support for the podcast. I am grateful that we have a lot of people who do, which is why I give them a few minutes each week at the beginning of the show to give them a mention. Because it's the least that I can do. I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Stephen Handyman Halistic, the Venom John Iru, Dastardly Derek Smith, it's good to hear from Derek this week, Josh the Shooter Stockton, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Ostentatious Alan Carter, Night Stalker Naef Al-Safar, who I've also been hearing a lot from on the YouTube streams. Naef is everywhere. He's always lurking in the shadows. The Guardian Angel, Jake, that's why he's called the Night Stalker. The Guardian Angel, Jacob Donnelly, Dark Skies, Ryan Spies, the Firebomber, Craig Foster, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto. And I want to wish a very happy birthday to the Ambassador of Disaster, Chase Wood. And your family has a message for you as well. And that message is very simple. Happy birthday from all of your family to the true Ambassador of Disaster, Chase Wood. He is celebrating his birthday this Thursday. And I hope it's a great one. Chase has been a fan of the show now for a couple of years. And I just have to tell you, you've got a great family there. You are a lucky guy to have that kind of love and support. So enjoy it. I hope you have a great birthday. And hopefully, I guess this is my birthday gift to you. So hopefully you enjoy the show this week. But again, Chase, a very happy birthday to you from not only me, but your entire family. And also some love to BB8. That's double B and the number 8 on iTunes for dropping 5 stars and a very nice review for the show. We got more shouts coming out in a little bit here, so if you didn't hear your name mentioned or your plug, don't worry, it's coming up. We got more to come. So after I just got done talking about the Miz's Wipeout wannabe game show, that cannonball show, I was just talking about this a week ago. We found out that Wipeout is coming back soon, this time on TBS. Yes, Wipeout is coming back. I guess TBS actually ordered 20 episodes to reboot the show back in April. The fact that Wipeout is coming back is not necessarily news, since this broke earlier this year. Either I completely forgot about it, or I just missed the news at the time. I saw a Variety story about Wipeout coming back, and it had a quote in the article from Kevin Riley of Warner Media / HBO Max. And I saw that and I said, wait a minute, how old is this article? Kevin Riley's the one who greenlit AEW Dynamite. He's also the one who got fired last month. So then I looked at the byline of this Variety article and it was from April. So the news has been out there. But this week, just to kind of tie it back to wrestling, John Cena was announced as one of the new hosts of the show. John Cena has facial hair now, which is very weird to see. But his whole look has changed. He's got the facial hair. He's got the weird hair now. He's like a totally different person. He and Nicole Byer will be the new co-hosts with Camille Kostek as the new host in the field, who interviews the contestants in between all of the obstacles. I thought I knew that name from somewhere, and I guess that's Rob Gronkowski's girlfriend. So she's going to be kind of the roving reporter. I'm going to miss Jill Wagner. Jill Wagner was just the best. They had Vanessa Lachey at one point. She was the reporter, and she was pretty good. But Jill Wagner was the best. Jill Wagner was just fun. But the big balls are back. But they are reimagining the show. That's the word they're using. And I always cringe when I hear that show. It's being reimagined. How many movies has Hollywood tried to reimagine? It doesn't always end well. Maybe we need Vince McMahon to reimagine Monday Night Raw. What would that look like? Probably no different, since it's still Vince McMahon's show. But each game, I guess, now during the show is going to have a 3-stage obstacle course consisting of multiple strategy and decision-making points designed to further challenge and wear out the stamina of the competitors. You want to wear out their stamina. You'll force them to sit and watch all 5 hours of that AEW show last weekend. If they can do that, then they can get to the final boss. All 3 hours of Monday Night Raw. Guarantee you that'll wear anybody out. I mean, look, I like AEW and all, but that show is too fucking long. I don't care what anybody says. Felt like it would never end. Even good shows can be too long. So I can't wait. I can't wait for that. They have not given a date yet, only that it's coming soon. John Cena is not the only wrestler with a new show coming to TBS. AEW on Dynamite this week was teasing a major announcement from Cody at the end of the show, and it piqued my interest. I said, okay, well, you know, we haven't seen him or heard from him since Brody Lee destroyed him on TV last month. They've been very vague on TV about updates about his injury, very secretive about it for some reason, and I thought this was a big angle that they were setting up for, a big return. But instead, it was an announcement about a new competition show that he is going to be a judge on, called The Go Big Show, which has nothing to do with Big Show. It's called The Go Big Show. This is why they shot the injury angle. We now know why. I mean, I still think he was taping something for that Stephen Amell show, but this would obviously be the main reason why they took him off TV. It's going to air next year. They're taping it at the Macon Coliseum in Georgia with no audience members in the building. Instead, they're going to have a drive-in audience outside. It's like a drive-in movie. Snoop Dogg, Rosario Dawson, and Jennifer Nettles are the other judges along with Cody. It's going to have alligators. It's going to have monster trucks. Because nothing screams Americana like alligators and monster trucks. And pro wrestling, right? Pro wrestling. There you go. That's the triple threat right there for America. Alligators, monster trucks, and pro wrestling. And I guess the winner of the show gets $100,000. So because they're being very careful with COVID, everybody on set is basically quarantined together, which would explain why they had to get him off TV. So when that's done, he'll be back. Look, it's good exposure for Cody to be hanging out with those guys on TV. Makes him feel like a big star or a bigger star. I just thought it was lame. The way they kind of teased it out like that, you could have just put the press release out right before they went on the air that night. And during the show, you could have made an announcement. It's kind of the way WWE does when The Miz or John Cena or The Rock or there's some kind of announcement they want to make about a big project or a big movie or a big TV show they're working on. I just think it was a little, it was misleading. It was a letdown. because I thought it had something to do with the storyline, since we haven't seen this guy on TV in several weeks. And it was just lame for them to build up a major announcement like that for a guy who the last time we saw him was being carried away. And it turns out to be an advertisement for another show, and he looks perfectly fine. So I guess Cody's going to be okay, guys. Brody Lee beat the piss out of him, but in the end, it wasn't all that bad. Cody's going to be just fine. WWE talent got some clarification this week on the whole third-party policy fiasco that we talked about last week. They are not to use their WWE character names on third-party platforms like YouTube and Twitch and Cameo to make money without WWE being involved. And that part at least makes sense. And I said last week, I said if it turns out to be that they just can't use their character names on these platforms, then that makes sense. But as far as whether or not they can continue to use their real names on some of these platforms and just continue to do the things that they've been doing, there is still some confusion about that. It is not a dead issue yet. There is still confusion about that. It sounds like it's going to be handled on a case-by-case situational basis. Andrew Yang, I didn't mention him last week because I didn't see the point. I mean, it's just another voice in the conversation. But Andrew Yang, who dropped out of the presidential race earlier this year, he is a legitimate wrestling fan. After the story broke last week, he had tweeted about the independent contractor farce that Vince McMahon, and other promoters too, other promoters benefit from this farce as well. Vince McMahon just so happens to be the biggest one who has, you know, fought against it and has benefited from it. But this independent contractor misclassification that they've gotten away with now for decades. Isn't that right, Stephanie?
So our talent are all independent contractors. So we actually don't provide medical insurance for our talent.
Saying that if he is not the next labor secretary, then he's going to have a conversation with whoever is about doing something about the issue. He sat down for a 20-minute interview on Chris Van Vliet's podcast this week to talk about this whole situation. I thought he came across well. It was very clear that he is a real fan. He's not just paying lip service and saying, oh, you know, I used to watch wrestling, or oh, yeah, I'm a casual wrestling fan. He's a legitimate big-time wrestling fan. You have to be a real fan to drop references to the fake Diesel and the fake Razor Ramon. And he said his favorite wrestlers growing up were the Macho Man Randy Savage and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. He was a big fan of their match at WrestleMania 3. And that he referred to it as just plain fucking greed. In his words, that Vince McMahon can make all of this money off talent and they're not allowed to do anything without WWE say so. They basically own you. But yet you are an independent contractor. And we have nothing to do, he says, with your health, your retirement, or any of the benefits that you would have if you were an employee. Like the folks in the tower, right? The folks in the tower at Stanford are all employees. So in his view, you have to make a choice. That's his biggest thing. At some point, you have to make a choice about what you really are. And if you are going to control all of these aspects of being a wrestler, then he feels that you should have to take some responsibility for that person. Now, Eric Bischoff, I didn't listen to his whole podcast, but I heard he had talked about the issue, and I heard the segment where he gave his thoughts on this whole, you know, the whole independent contractor thing or wrestlers unionizing thing. And on his podcast, he talked about the idea of wrestlers unionizing and said that you've got to be careful what you wish for because that shit can come back to kill you. He says it could change the whole compensation structure. And there are financial consequences to doing that. Now, I can see where if this were to become an industry-wide thing, which it would have to be, it would bankrupt a lot of indie promotions who may not be able to, who would not be able to afford to run anymore. Some of the bigger indies, I mean, depending on how things are structured, they may be okay. But yes, a lot of promotions would probably go belly up if this became an industry-wide standard that was being enforced, and if there was oversight in some way. But that's still no excuse to misclassify them. That is not an excuse. The reality is, though, what Andrew Yang says, it's nice and all, but nothing ever changes. When it comes to pro wrestling, nothing ever changes, and nothing is going to change here either. Politicians, they might raise a fuss every few years about it. Remember all the congressional inquiries that we were going to get? coming out of the Chris Benoit stuff. This was over a decade ago. And we even got testimony. There was testimony from certain people. There was testimony that leaked from Vince McMahon, where he was asked about WWE's policy of offering rehab. And this was just one small part of it. You can find the transcripts online. It's fascinating to hear some of his responses, but maybe no more fascinating than this one. And no more of a window, I think, into the guy's mind than when they asked him about their policy, which was at the time, I think, a relatively new policy they had just imposed of offering rehab to any talent that has ever worked for them ever before, rehab for any addiction issues they may have. And there have been a lot of wrestlers that have taken them up on that offer over the years, from Jake Roberts to Scott Hall to Sean Waltman to Ron Simmons, countless others. Others we don't even know about, but who in some cases say that it helped save their lives, that it was a positive thing. It's a nice thing that they do, and they don't have to do it. But when he was asked, why did you start doing it? He had two words: public relations. His exact answer was public relations. That's it. I don't feel any sense of responsibility for anyone, whatever their age, who has had bad habits and who overdoses on drugs. Well, at least he was honest. You get Vince McMahon under oath, at least you're going to get some honest answers out of him. Should have asked him what was in the briefcase, but that's a different story. But where did all these congressional inquiries go after that? Where did they go? They went nowhere. They went nowhere because wrestling is not important enough. And that is still true today. Think of all the shit going on in the world right now. You think wrestling is going to be a priority to these people? Of course not. Of course not. Nothing will change. Nothing will change. The only ones with the power to truly change things, and I said this last week, the only ones with the power to truly change things are the talent. And they're making good enough money to where they're not going to want to do anything. Nobody wants to upset the apple cart. So, again, I can appreciate him being a fan and not liking hearing these stories all these years, as he said about all these wrestlers dying young. And he name-dropped Kurt Hennig, and he name-dropped Ravishing Rick Rude, and all these wrestlers from his youth that he remembers who aren't here today. And it's a terrible thing. And I don't know if these changes would have helped all those people. Some people are just into shit they shouldn't be into, right? How many of those people would still be here? Some of them probably would be, not all of them. So I can appreciate him being concerned about that. I think as fans, we all feel the same way. We all wish these guys were still around. Rick Rude and Mr. Perfect and Owen Hart and Yokozuna and the Bulldog, all these people who had families and kids. God, I wish they were still here. It's horrendous to go back and watch these old shows and you're counting all the dead bodies, and it's not even like they'd be that old. But at the end of the day, nothing is going to change. Sorry. You can call me a cynic, but you know I'm right. Burning Hammer. Bulmaro Hernandez is celebrating his 32nd birthday today. Happy birthday, Bulmaro. He's been listening since episode 338. And Armando from Puerto Rico, he and his brother have been listening since 2015. Today is also his birthday. Boy, a lot of September babies. I'm an October baby myself. My birthday's coming up soon. Hi, I'm Chris Evans. He has a new video up on his YouTube channel called The Blackest Marks You Know. That is the channel name. Talking about the awful Seth Rollins, Fiend, Bray Wyatt, Hell in a Cell match last year. And re-watching the match with his pals. If you're the one who forced them to rewatch this match, then you ain't no pal. You ain't no pal of mine. That's where the friendship ends. You're going to force me to rewatch that garbage. But they rewatched it to see if it still sucks as much as it did the first time around. I won't spoil it for you, although you can probably guess the answer. So go ahead and check that out. He also asked if I thought Thunder Rosa working with AEW will one day lead to the NWA World Heavyweight Champion stepping foot into an AEW ring? Absolutely. Do I think it could happen? Absolutely. And finally here, Bear Claw, Wendell Baugh. You may know Wendell from the Facebook group. He's got his own Twitch channel, where he streams Final Fantasy XIV and Kingdom Hearts. He's usually streaming Final Fantasy from 3 to 6 p.m. Mountain Time every day. So give him a follow on there. I know he would appreciate it. That's twitch.tv/Yozo. Well, let me make sure I say this right. Yozora Heart. Yozora Heart. Yozora Heart. That's the place to go. And he points out also that anyone who has Amazon Prime can subscribe for free. And he gets a super kickback for it. So there you go. Go check out Wendell's Twitch channel. There was another round of WWE cuts this week, but this time the talent was spared, thankfully for them. One source told PW Insider they believed up to 60, or somewhere between 60 and 70 staff members were let go, many of whom had been furloughed months ago. The most shocking of them, though, that we know of, maybe we don't even know all the names, but the most shocking name that came out, who was released this week, was Gerald Briscoe, who had been with the company for 36 years. We've had 36 WrestleManias. That's how long Gerald Briscoe has worked for Vince McMahon. And I thought Mike Chioda would hold the record this year for the longest tenured employee. I don't know, would Mike Chioda have been considered an employee? Because I would think the referees are independent contractors, just like the talent. I don't know. That's actually a good question. We should hear from a WWE referee. Anybody who's listening can reach out to me and let me know. But I figured that he would have the record for this year, at least, of being the longest tenured person there let go. He was there 33 years. And Briscoe had him beat by a few more. At least in this case, unlike Chioda, who was completely caught off guard and did not get a call from any of the McMahons, Vince McMahon actually did make the call directly himself to personally deliver the bad news to Gerald Briscoe. Briscoe later tweeted, he said, "Okay, I want to get this out the right way. Last night I received a call from Vince McMahon to let me know that after 36 years of dedication to WWE, that I am no longer needed. I am okay with this. I will be around to help talent. I also would like to add that I need a little space. So everyone asking for an interview at this time, I need to step back and take a deep breath. Just remember, I have no anger, just emotions at this time." Now, Briscoe was furloughed back in April, as were many others. It appears they're letting go. It looks like they're letting go of the old guard in favor of holding on to the newer producers, the younger producers. There is said to be bitterness from some of the older folks, the released ones. I shouldn't say older folks, from some of the ones that were let go. Because they were led to believe that they would be brought back, or there was a very good chance that they would be brought back. Now, you know, put yourself in that position. If you were furloughed in April, and you were led to believe that, I think originally they were led to believe, we're probably going to bring a lot of you guys back the very end of June, beginning of July. If I remember, I think that was the line that they were given. And then July turned into August, August turned into September. So you've been waiting all this time, right? Let's say you've been waiting now 5 months, figuring you're going to come back, only to then be told you're gone. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of bitterness there. There's going to be a lot of unhappiness there because you were expecting to be brought back. And some people were, but for whatever reason, you weren't. So obviously, those people are going to be upset. Briscoe, though, says he's okay with it. He's already teasing some kind of announcement. He's teasing news of some kind that's dropping on Wednesday. So we'll see what that is. The man turned 74 years old this coming Saturday. He had a hell of a run. You know, Jerry and his brother Jack, and I know a lot of you know this story already. Some of you might not. But it's always fun to regale with wrestling history. Jerry and Jack played a very big role in one of the more infamous events in wrestling history, Black Saturday. Some of you probably lived through it. Some of you were probably NWA fans who put the TV on that day and were shocked by what you saw, shocked and appalled by what you saw on TBS that day. So we go back to 1984. Vince McMahon is looking to expand nationally, right? He's taken over already from his father. He's looking to take this whole thing nationally. He's not interested in just being a player in the Northeast anymore. He wants to just take over the whole damn thing. And he has the slot on USA Network, but he wants to go beyond that. He wanted a second cable outlet for his shows. Georgia Championship Wrestling was the only other promotion with a national clearance on cable, and that was on the Superstation, TBS. And Ted Turner was always very fond of wrestling because when the Superstation was first created and it was in its infancy, wrestling was one of the things that he put on the channel and did very well. In fact, it probably did better than any of the other programming he had. So Ted Turner always had an affinity for pro wrestling. And Ted Turner used to have a lot of power. He has a lot of money, and he had a lot of power. And so having Ted Turner as an ally of yours was good for pro wrestling. So Georgia Championship Wrestling was on TBS, and Vince McMahon made an offer, as the story goes, to Ted Turner for the slot, and Turner rejected that offer. And so after that, Vince McMahon, of course, he wasn't going to give up so easily. He got wind of some turmoil that was going on behind the scenes in GCW at the time. They had multiple owners. Ole Anderson was one of them. Ole Anderson also was the head booker. And the other owners were not very happy with some of the things that Ole was doing. They weren't getting along very well with Ole. What a surprise. I mean, Ole comes across as such a likable guy in all of his shoot interviews. I can't imagine why people wouldn't get along with Ole Anderson. So Vince McMahon approached the other owners. He didn't approach Ole. Ole had no idea this was going on. Vince approached the other owners, and that included Jack and Jerry, who had a stake in the promotion. And so the Briscoes and Jim Barnett all agreed to sell their stakes to Vince McMahon, which gave Vince McMahon controlling interest, and there was nothing that Ole could do about it. By the time he found out it was a done deal, he was overruled. And obviously he wasn't very happy about it. That they then gave Vince McMahon access to that Saturday time slot, that coveted Saturday time slot that he wanted to take over. It gave him a monopoly on over pro wrestling on cable. So imagine the surprise of all of those NWA fans, all those Georgia Championship Wrestling fans, when they tuned into their beloved show on that day, and the first face they saw after the, Freddie Miller. I think it was Freddie Miller? I don't know, Freddie Miller, or whoever the host was usually the one to throw it to Gordon Solie. And instead of throwing it to Gordon Solie, who did he introduce? He introduced Vince McMahon. And it's still such a weird image to see screenshots or watch the video and you see Vince in that studio, you know, with the backdrop and everything where Solie would usually be standing. And there's Vince McMahon looking completely out of place. And he introduces Vince. And what's worse is that not only were there more WWF matches then featured on the show, because it was matches, I think, from different places, but there were more WWF matches. A lot of those matches were matches that McMahon had already aired on the USA Network shows and in syndication. So it was just a rerun of matches that had already aired on TV. It wasn't even like there was any effort put into having special matches that had never been seen before. He just wanted the slot so he can take matches from the other shows and just rerun them on TBS. And if you were an NWA fan who despised the Vince McMahon version of pro wrestling back then you were very angry when you saw that. And it wasn't very long before Vince sold the slot back to, he sold it to Jim Crockett for $1 million. And allegedly told Crockett when the sale went through, he allegedly said to Crockett, "I'm going to make you choke on that million." So that was Briscoe's role in that whole fiasco. He even admits that Vince McMahon brought Gorilla Monsoon with him to the studio that first day, I guess to stand backstage as his heavy, in case anyone tried anything. He brought the gorilla along as his bodyguard to make sure things didn't go sideways. Was Monsoon going to pick the guy up in an airplane spin or something? I mean, I know Monsoon had wrestled, but even at that point in 84, I mean, some of the big guys they had down there, I don't know. I mean, I guess Gorilla probably could have held his own, but I don't know what he would have done. But out of it, Briscoe got a job for life with Vince McMahon, or a job for 36 years anyway. But he's been a talent scout for the company for decades. He's helped discover, he's credited with discovering a whole bunch of different people. The most high-profile ones probably are Kurt Angle. I mean, Kurt Angle was known anyway once he won the gold medal, but he helped recruit Kurt Angle. He helped discover and recruit Brock Lesnar. who made a lot of money for the company, made a lot of money for himself, but has made a lot of money for the company over the years. Shelton Benjamin. Shelton Benjamin as well, who has recently found new life on TV with the Hurt Business. He and Benjamin now have something in common. They've both held the 24/7 ugly green belt. It was the last time we saw Briscoe on TV last summer. I think he beat Pat Patterson and won the 24/7 title. He was the person responsible for timing the shows in the back for many years. But then he had to scale back on his workload because he had suffered a series of strokes. If you were a fan during the Attitude Era, though, you will remember him as one of the Stooges. He was one of Vince McMahon's Stooges, Pat Patterson and Gerald Briscoe. He said Patterson hated it when people used that word. So Jerry would rib him all the time. He would say, Jerry, he would go, Pat, we're a bunch of Stooges. He would go, no, don't use that word. He goes, but that's what we are. He said we spent our entire careers trying to earn everyone's respect and trying to be remembered as legends and all that. And the thing that we're going to be remembered the most for, he said, is being a couple of comedy stooges on TV for Vince McMahon. And it's true. It's kind of sad, but, I mean, it's true in a lot of ways. I mean, Patterson, he'll be remembered for a lot more than just that. But it is kind of true. That's how a lot of fans are going to remember those two guys. You know, but it just goes to show you, to the victors, they get to write history the way that they want to write history. Ole Anderson wasn't the victor. Jim Crockett was not the victor. Ted Turner was not the victor. At least in terms of wrestling. Vince McMahon was. In the end, Vince McMahon was, and that's how, if that's how you're portrayed on his television show, then that's how you're going to be remembered. His show reaches a lot of people. More so than, I mean, more so back then. But his show reaches a lot of people. I love the Stooges, though. The Stooges were very entertaining. I was never a big fan of the Three Stooges, but the WWE Stooges, I thought they were very entertaining. But I thought Briscoe would be a lifer. I guess everybody in that company, though, has an expiration date. Whether your name is Mark Yeaton, the timekeeper, Mike Chioda, the referee, or Gerald Briscoe, it doesn't matter. Everyone's got an expiration date. Briscoe was not the only legend to be let go this past week. Mike Rotunda, IRS, was let go. He had been working behind the scenes for the company since 2006. They furloughed him on tax day this year. They furloughed IRS on tax day, as if that wasn't insulting enough. And in the end, they opted not to bring him back. Sarah Stock, she was released as well. She had also been furloughed in April. She initially signed 5 years ago to come to the company as a coach at the PC. They ended up transitioning her to a producer role backstage on the main roster. She had wrestled for years as Dark Angel, Sarita in TNA, right? She wrestled as tag team partners with Zelina Vega back in Zelina's days as Rosita. But she never wrestled for WWE. They strictly brought her in to work off camera. Those are the only name people that we know of at this point. There may have been others that have a name that were cut as well. So more names may come out, but the live events division, and this is probably a big part of why people like Rotunda were probably let go. The live events division is just said to be completely in shambles at this point. It got hit very hard. In that division alone, there were at least a dozen or more people that were cut because they're not running live events. WWE, for the first time in its history, modern history, has not run live events, live non-televised events with people in the crowds, which for so long was the bread and butter of their business. I mean, it's what they do. It's like the traveling circus, right? They go everywhere. They travel the country. They travel the world. And they have not been able to do that since March. And there's no sign that they're going to be able to do it anytime soon. Probably not until next year. So with no live events, you know, you're going to have, unfortunately, a situation like this where the people who work specifically in that division are no longer needed. Maybe you can reassign them to other parts of the company, but in a lot of cases, they're just going to, you know, they're going to say, well, thanks, but see you later. And they're going to kick you out. I don't think their live event business is ever going to go back to the way it was. It's never going to be the same. After this, it's never going to be the same again. They had already started scaling back a little bit on the number of house shows they were doing. I don't think they will ever fully go away, at least not in the big markets like New York and Chicago, L.A. I mean, believe me, they have their annual post-Christmas show at Madison Square Garden. That may not happen this year, but events like that will come back at some point. They're never going to completely stop doing those types of shows. But the WWE live event business, the live event model, as it existed previously, even at the very beginning of this year, I truly believe is over and dead, and it's not coming back. I don't think it will ever be the same again, and I don't think they need to run as many events as they were running. But I can see where if they're not running any live events, you can see why the talent would be upset about that, because whatever money they would get or bonuses or whatever from the live events has completely dried up, which could explain why some of them have taken to services like Twitch and Cameo. You know, you got somebody like Paige, who is very popular on Twitch and is probably pulling in a few hundred grand. Based on the numbers that I've seen just from Twitch, you know, you're not going to leave money like that on the table. So that's kind of the update on that situation this week. We'll see if more names come out in the days ahead as far as people who are no longer with the company. Here's something I learned this week. You may have heard of Crazy Steve, right? You've heard Josh Matthews go, Crazy Steve! You've heard of Crazy Steve from Impact Wrestling. He was in a couple of factions there many years ago. The Menagerie, The Decay, with Abyss. Before he left the company. That was years ago. Then he left, and he had a tryout with WWE. I remember hearing about that. This is probably 3 years ago. Did not get signed. And then earlier this year, he made his return to Impact Wrestling. And so he is back on TV now. I know he was part of some of those recent Wrestle House skits that they did on Impact. Well, he was a guest this week on Tommy Dreamer's House of Hardcore podcast, and he talked about being legally blind. Now, it's kind of breaking news, but not really. I mean, it's something that was known by some people. I think he did an Ask Me Anything on Reddit a number of years ago and just kind of casually mentioned it there. But this was not something that was commonly known. I certainly didn't know. I'm sure there's other fans who weren't aware of this. They may not even know who Crazy Steve is, but to me, this is an amazing story. So he was born totally blind. He had cataracts on his eyes. He had them removed. I guess it didn't help. He could kind of see a little bit after that, but I guess it got worse. He has glaucoma. He cannot drive. But he refers to himself as the Michael Jordan of not seeing, because he is really, really good at it. And when he first joined Impact, they had him doing X Division matches. Now, X Division matches are fast-paced, a lot of aerial moves, a lot of high-flying, a lot of dives, all that kind of stuff. And he would have to tell guys, he would say, look, you can't dive out onto me because I'm blind. And I will not be able to catch you. It would be a very bad idea for you to attempt to dive out onto me. However, I'm going to dive out onto you. So, catch me. And a lot of it with him when he's out there, I guess, is really, it's just feel. You know, he's talked about how the lighting can really affect things and the color of the ring ropes. If it's brighter or darker, then he wouldn't be able to see anything. If you watch his matches, I don't think you would ever know. I mean, I certainly never did. That, to me, is the most impressive thing. And that's, you know, in the interview, he talked about how he never wanted to make it an issue. The reason a lot of people didn't know up until now, or the last few years, is because he didn't want that to be what he was defined by. You know, I think back to somebody like Zach Gowen or something. And to me, he's another amazing story. At the time, he was a young kid, 20 years old, I think, brought into WWE. He was on television wrestling Roddy Piper and Vince McMahon and in the ring with Hulk Hogan on TV. What a moment that must have been for him. But he only had one leg. He had the prosthetic leg, but he would pull it off and he would wrestle with one leg. Now, that's something you can't hide. Kerry Von Erich can hide the missing foot because there are ways that you can disguise that. Zach Gowen, somebody like him in his situation, he didn't have that luxury. And so that became his whole story. His whole story was the one-legged man who wants to become a pro wrestler. But in this case, It's just incredible to me that you would never know. Now, if you were wrestling him, I would imagine that you could probably tell very quickly in terms of making eye contact and stuff like that. But, you know, credit to him. He became known as a good wrestler. And nobody looked at him and go, well, man, he's really good for a blind guy. No, he was really good, period. And that's what he always wanted. He didn't want to be defined by his condition. He wanted people just to think, hey, Crazy Steve's a pretty good wrestler. And then after the fact, it was like, oh, by the way, he's blind. It's like, what? I mean, that's an amazing thing. It never ceases to amaze me what people are capable of. The evil things in this world that people are capable of, but also the inspirational things. It's amazing to me. He's never seen the audience before. He can hear them. He can react to them. He can feed off of them, but he cannot actually see them. He cannot see the audience. Well, I mean, he wouldn't see them now anyway, because they have no fans in the audience. But he cannot see the audience. I wonder if WWE knew this when they brought him in for that tryout. I mean, it's possible they knew and they just, you know, he had a tryout and they weren't impressed, but I wonder. I wonder if somebody clued them in beforehand, like, hey, this guy's blind. And if that had anything to do with why he didn't get signed by the company. Because I know there were some people who were surprised that he had the tryout and it didn't go anywhere. So I don't know. I don't know if they had knowledge of this in advance or if that just became something they found out once he actually showed up. But anyway, I thought that was a pretty incredible thing to learn. If you didn't already know it, now you do. Now you do. And you can watch Crazy Steve on Impact every Tuesday night. He's been back on the roster this year and he's doing his thing. And from that story, which is very nice, very inspirational, we come to Sad Tweet. And Sad Tweet of the Week goes to Ryback, who clearly is no fan of Dave Meltzer. Which is fine. There's a lot of people who are not fans of Dave Meltzer. But I cannot say the same for his idiotic tweet. The idiotic tweet that he posted this week, but not before deleting his original tweet, which was screenshotted before he deleted it because the internet never forgets. I don't know exactly what triggered this reaction from him. I don't know what prompted this from him. He did not say. Maybe he said on his podcast. He certainly didn't say in this tweet what prompted this. The first tweet, before he deleted it, said, I firmly believe the world would be a better place with Dave Meltzer 6 feet under. He is the most dangerous kind of mark there is and puts out lies for profit, creating hate for people he dislikes. He makes money off other diseased marks, but does so in a horrible way. And then he either realized what a completely messed up thing that was to say, or he got called out on it, which, let's be honest, that's exactly what happened. Because any person with a shred of decency to them would have called this moron out for saying such a stupid thing. So he deleted it, and then he posted more or less the same tweet, but with the 6 feet under part taken out. It says, I firmly believe the world would be a better place without Dave Meltzer. He is the most dangerous kind of mark there is, and blah, 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 you know the rest. Have the protein shakes seeped into his brain and rotted it away? Is that what's going on here? I think it's very rich that somebody who frequently preaches positivity and the power of positive thinking, as Ryback now does, as he promotes all of his various products, but he's all about positivity. I find it rich that he would tweet that the world would be a better place if wrestling reporter Dave Meltzer, like he's fucking Pol Pot or Mussolini, that the world would be a much better place. Dave Meltzer, by the way, who's been doing this, what he does, longer than Ryback has been alive on this earth. The world would be a much better place if wrestling reporter Dave Meltzer was worm food. Look, I don't agree with everything Meltzer says. Not everything he reports turns out to be 100% accurate all of the time. But there is a reason that every wrestling news website and every wrestling podcast, more than any other single source, still cites The Observer when it comes out. Still cites The Observer when it comes to news. There's a reason for that. And one thing that I have learned in doing all of those RSPW Rewind segments now for a year, been doing this segment now for over a year, is that Meltzer bashing was a favorite pastime of certain people for decades, going back to at least the early 90s and probably even earlier than that. But I have found evidence of it going back to the early 90s. And also the favorite pastime of a lot of very bitter wrestlers. The only diseased one here is Ryback. Maybe he was hangry when he posted that tweet. Eat another chip and enjoy your award for said tweet. But it's not made out of chocolate, so don't eat the fucking thing. It was another week and another Monday Night Raw where nobody knew what the hell was going on, because Vince McMahon did not read the script until he got onto the private jet to fly down to Orlando at the Thunderdome. Drew McIntyre was back. He arrived in an ambulance for reasons that were never explained. And he gave Randy Orton his first of three Claymore kicks throughout the night. His revenge for Orton giving him three punt kicks. Big Papa Pump, I noticed, was trending on Twitter for a while, and I legit thought he was dead. But it was only because the siren noises from the ambulance had people thinking that Scott Steiner was coming out and making his big return. Which, anybody who has heard Scott Steiner interviewed and talking about WWE and the McMahons and Vince and Stephanie over the years and Triple H knows that that will never happen. They say never in wrestling. I'm going to say never. I'm going to say never. And I'm sure that, by the way, is the feeling on both sides, not just on Scott Steiner's end. Cedric Alexander is officially a member of the Hurt Business. They went the predictable route to the story that they've been building for a few months now, which is fine, but this dragged out long enough and seemed so obvious that I was starting to think that, you know, between that and the comments Mark Henry made recently on Busted Open Radio about how he wishes Ricochet would get angry. And I took that to mean more behind the scenes than on camera necessarily. It just made me think that this might all be a swerve and that Ricochet was the one who was going heel, but it was Cedric. In a match that saw Cedric, Ricochet, and Apollo Crews take on Lashley, MVP, and Shelton Benjamin. Apollo was reaching for the tag. Ricochet was yanked off the apron by Cedric, who threw him into the barricade. Ricochet took this great upside-down bump. Landed right on his head, but it was a great bump. Lumbar checked by Alexander to Crews, and Benjamin hit pay dirt to win the match for the Hurt Business. MVP, Lashley, and Benjamin, they're all smiling. They're looking over at Cedric, who's outside the ring, smiling back at them. He never got into the ring and hugged them or joined them or anything. They just stood there from afar, smiling at each other. They all did the long, awkward staring at one another that has become a hallmark of these WWE shows. Everybody does it. You have to stare. Somebody does something egregious to you and you come out to try to get him, and they get out of the ring too quickly and they kind of run up the aisleway and they turn around and they look at you. You are incapable of exiting the ring and running after them. You have to stand there and make a mean face and just stare at them from a distance. That's how it works in WWE. There is a force field around the ring. You are not allowed to chase after that person. If this was not a three-hour show, they would make you wait until next week to hear from Cedric, the first big promo with the Hurt Business and their new member, to find out why he did what he did. But they have a lot of time to kill, so they actually brought these guys back out for a promo and a match later in the show. So they shot 2 weeks' worth of angles here on this one show. And unfortunately, it led to a big injury, which I'm going to talk about here in a little bit. Perhaps that injury would not have happened if this match was saved for the following week. The Street Profits beat Andrade and Angel Garza again, Groundhog Day in September. See, the problem I have with this, these matches are not good enough to warrant seeing them 17,000 times in a row. Even Flair Steamboat or Austin Rock would get old if you do them enough times in a row. These matches are not that good that they need to be done over and over and over again like this. But the only saving grace about this one, I guess, is it went 2 minutes. It was more of a storyline than a match. It had Garza walking out on Andrade, leaving him all by himself to lose. So hopefully that means no more matches between these two teams, because I'm sick of it. And we can move the story along with Garza and Andrade and just feud them already. They could probably have some kick-ass singles matches. Just get to it, please. Vince McMahon, he remembered the brand-to-brand invitational that he created months ago, and the SmackDown Tag Team Champions Cesaro and Shinsuke Nakamura, they appeared on Monday Night Raw to cut a promo on the Raw Tag Team Champions, the Street Profits. More likely, what happened here is that Vince McMahon realized that tomorrow night is the return of Monday Night Football. And so he decided to book a champions, I guess you can call it a champion showcase match, champions against champions, Raw versus SmackDown. And here I thought, silly me, you know, we're told every year at Survivor Series, it's the one time of year that we get to see Raw versus SmackDown. So if the announcers make that claim again in November, we can call them out on their bullshit. Because in fact, it is not the only time during the year where we get to see Raw versus SmackDown. Can't say that anymore. I was hoping. I actually was happy when I saw Cesaro and Shinsuke come out. Because what I thought, what I naively believed, was that it meant they were building to a unification match at Clash of Champions. Every title has to be defended at Clash of Champions. And so what other reason would there be for having the SmackDown Tag Team Champions on Raw than to set up the challenge for Clash of Champions, where both titles would be on the line and defended in the same match, and the winning team would be the unified WWE Tag Team Champions, who would then be allowed to float like the Women's Tag Team Champions are? They would be allowed to float from one brand to the other, because the Tag Team Division on Raw and the Tag Team Division on SmackDown at the moment, they are largely ass right now. There's a good word for it. They are ass. They are not very good. I think the sum of those parts would be stronger than the individual parts themselves. But that's not what they did. They're trying to pop a rating tomorrow night, and they're going to do the match on the show. Now, what the outcome of this match is going to be, it could still lead to a match at Clash of Champions. We could still get the SmackDown Tag Team Champions against the Raw Tag Team Champions. And you know what? I will give this credit to the company. If we watch the show tomorrow night and there is a non-finish, and the whole point of it is to build to what I just talked about, perhaps the idea, because I just cannot see how the people in this company would look at these tag team divisions and be proud and be happy with the quality of these tag team divisions. They are not good. You don't need two sets of titles. You just don't. If they had any sense in their brain, they would realize this. And so maybe tomorrow night we'll find out that no finish. Gonna run it back again at Clash of Champions, only this time both belts are gonna be on the line. That is the correct outcome. And hopefully they'll do the right thing. Find out tomorrow night. More often than not, I end up coming back on the podcast the week after and saying they did not do the right thing. On occasion, though, like a broken clock, right? It's always going to be right twice a day. On occasion, they do get it right. I'm hoping this is one of those cases. Now, after the big split between the Iconics the week before, we got a singles match this week between Peyton Royce and Billie Kay. They had a 3-minute match. Peyton won with a neck breaker, and then she helped up her former partner, and they hugged. Here you have two women who were portrayed on television for their entire run as the obnoxious heels on TV for years. I'm not really sure who the people were supposed to be rooting for here in this match. You know, was it Billie Kay because Peyton Royce threw her back into the ring on Raw Underground a few weeks ago? I don't know. I mean, I don't think either one of them are really portrayed as being anything likable on TV. When we get the next superstar shakeup, whenever it's coming, it might be coming in October, these two are going to end up on different brands. Only question is who goes where. And as I look at these women's divisions right now, they could both use some work. Maybe not quite as much as the tag team division, I think, needs a boost. I guess it really doesn't matter. In the end, it really doesn't matter as long as you just get them on different brands. I still maintain that Billie Kay needs to just get away from Peyton, go off on her own, try to establish her own identity. Yeah, I didn't realize that Billie Kay has her own YouTube channel. I only learned that this week. I know she had done an interview with Chris Van Vliet. I was watching part of it. And she's a likable personality. I think you could have babyface Billie Kay and Peyton Royce goes off as a heel, maybe on the SmackDown brand to do her thing, and Billie stays on Raw. But you got to get them apart. You got to separate them. I think you do that in the shakeup. MVP hosted a VIP lounge introducing the newest member of the Hurt Business, Cedric Alexander, who said that he was tired of being on the wrong end of a beatdown. Now he's ready to learn and earn. Now, I should note that Shelton Benjamin was acting very skeptical of Alexander. He was trying to make sure this guy wasn't playing games with them. There is still a chance that this could all be an elaborate setup and he actually hasn't turned heel. I think that would be kind of dumb, considering what he did to his friends and the way they got beaten up. But I think it is official. I think he is a heel. This led to a match because we have 3 hours to fill. We got to put these guys back in the ring on the same show. We had the Hurt Business taking on the Viking Raiders, Ricochet, and Apollo Crews. And unfortunately, what came along with that was a very real injury to Ivar. And it came on a dive out of the ring. Now, I have ranted on these stupid dives so many times. What's one more, right? What's one more rant? And I want to make this very clear. I'm not trying to pick on Ivar. This, for me, was just kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. This is how I have felt for a long time. And then watching this poor guy get hurt just kind of set me off. I really, really, really wish they would leave the dives to the cruiserweights. I don't want to see Dexter Lumis doing dives out of the ring. Another one who got hurt recently on a dive and has not been seen on TV since. I don't need to see 350-pound Bronson Reed doing a dive as I saw him doing last week. I don't need to see 300-pound Ivar doing dives. All you're doing is asking for something bad to happen, and now it has. And everybody can bitch and bemoan the overuse of the super kick in wrestling. If that's your hill to die on, then great. I choose to die on the hill of all these dives in every match. Every company. Enough with the fucking dives. For the most part, I don't think this is much of a hot take here. For the most part, they all look like shit anyway. They look like shit. Everybody stands there and they wait for the person to dive onto them and then they take turns. They take turns so that everybody can dive. And they all get right back up and they move on to the next spot anyway. So what's the point? They don't look good. They do no damage, other than in this case to the person executing the move. The Undertaker used to dive out of the ring once a year, and it was a big deal. When big guys are diving out of the ring every night, it is no longer a big deal. This is across the board. I am not just talking about WWE. I'm not just taking them to task for allowing this to happen, because WWE is not telling them to dive. But they're allowing it to happen. They have allowed it to infect every single match on every single show every single week. Everyone, AEW, leave it for guys like Darby and Jungle Boy, but everybody else, you know, the Kenny Omega Terminator dive, and everybody else who does it, I'm sick of it. I am sick of the diving. If all these wrestlers want to dive so badly, then they should have gotten into swimming, not wrestling. You're not Michael fucking Phelps. Enough with the dives. And again, I'm not trying to beat up on Ivar here. Ivar was just the last straw that set me off on this. You guys know I have felt this way for a long time. And I always thought it was so selfish. Thought it was so selfish to take something that the smaller wrestlers have traditionally relied on so heavily to sort of set themselves apart from the bigger guys. You know, the bigger guys that would do the traditional power moves and power spots. You will have bigger guys that will do a move off the top rope and stuff. Vader, you know, Vader was doing a moonsault off the top rope. But he wasn't doing it every night. But I always thought it was so selfish to take that and start doing these dives like they were nothing. And now it doesn't even matter anymore because you'll have Ricochet doing a dive in one match. And in the next match, you'll have someone twice his size doing the same move. So you tell me, what's going to look more impressive? A 190-pound guy doing a dive or a 290-pound guy doing a dive? So Ivar did a dive out through the ropes to take out the Hurt Business. He wiped them all out. It did not look particularly devastating. It did not look as if he hurt himself. It did not look like he landed awkwardly or anything. Well, maybe a little awkwardly, but there was nothing that immediately would have told you, uh-oh, he landed wrong, he hurt himself, he broke something, something is wrong. The only reason we knew that something was wrong is because Ivar immediately put the X sign up with his hands. He did it himself. Usually the referee does it. In this case, Ivar knew instantly he knew something was wrong. And he was calling for help. And you could tell he was trying to regain the feeling in his hands, in his fingers, his fingertips, like maybe he suffered a stinger, lost some of the feeling in his extremities there briefly. We don't have a diagnosis yet other than a report saying that it's a cervical injury of some kind, and he could be out for a while. And that not only sucks for Ivar, it sucks for Eric too, because when you're in a tag team and your partner goes down with an injury, it affects your career every bit as much as it affects the person who actually got hurt. If you are in a tag team in WWE and your partner gets hurt, you are fucked. You are fucked. Rarely do they do anything with the other person. Look at Rosar of AOP. He got hurt earlier this year. And they took Akam off TV. There was nothing wrong as far as I can remember. There was nothing physically wrong with Akam. They were part of the Seth Rollins faction. Why couldn't they just keep Akam around? It's like the bodyguard or the muscle of the group. But they took him off TV, and then they waited 6 months when they were ready to come back, and then they fired him. You know, Jimmy Uso got hurt. And what happened? Jey Uso disappeared. Now, they did bring him back to TV after a while. But what has he done? What has he really done up until now? Now they're doing something with Jey Uso because they want to get Roman Reigns over as a bigger heel by having him destroy his own flesh and blood. That's why Jey Uso is getting this Universal title match at Clash of Champions. Not because we got some big plan for Jey Uso. It's because, you know, he's right place, right time. This is the perfect way to get Roman Reigns over as just an evil son of a bitch. He's going to beat the piss out of one of the members of his own family, his own cousin, one of his best friends. So we can use that. We can use Jey Uso. So now he's going to get a Universal title match at Clash of Champions. The one and only pay-per-view main event of his career. Good for him. Before this, what was the last thing that we really saw Jey Uso doing? He was hosting fucking karaoke contest on TV. That is the biggest drawback to being in a tag team. So I feel sorry for both of them. Ivar tweeted, he said, from the bottom of my heart, thank you to every single friend, fan, family that has reached out to me. My heart is truly touched from all the love and support. Still figuring it all out, but I'm working hard to recover and be better than ever. And I hope he does. I wish him all the best. I never like seeing anybody get hurt, but this is not an injury that had to happen. That's the other thing that pisses me off. This did not have to happen. I'm not even sure why they were out there. We already saw these people earlier in the show. Not the Vikings, but the other guys. There was no reason to run them back out there a second time in the same show. Other than, it's 3 hours and we have time to fill, and so now, here we are. And it sucks. The tag team champions, Shayna Baszler and Nia Jax, they had dueling handicap matches on this show against Ruby Riott and Liv Morgan. Shayna got rolled up off a distraction from Nia in the first match, and the second one had no finish because Retribution interrupted on the Titantron. They were all wearing masks. They had their voices distorted. Two of them spoke, first a woman and then a man. The dialogue here would be laughed out of a community theater play. Here, I can disguise my voice too.
Dome is only a facade. Behind this mountain of screens is the same foundation, the same WWE as before. The same behemoth who discarded and disowned us, leaving us to survive in an unfair world. Where the powerful continue to grow, while we are left to feed on nothing but scraps of contempt. Then we have the male voice. But contempt is a powerful motivator. We are driven to destroy, to lay waste to every superstar and every fan blinded. You cannot see what you do not have. so the locusts of contempt will feed upon all of you. The darkness of retribution will seep into the pores of every superstar in all of your so-called universe. We are retribution. God, this dialogue is shit. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. Wait, let me change my voice.
There we go. I almost did the entire rest of the podcast in that voice. Someone on Reddit used a website to edit the pitch for the audio. People did the same thing with the DDP stalker voice many years ago, before DDP was revealed as the Undertaker stalker, and you could hear that it was Vince McMahon doing the voice. So it's not hard to do. The man here was clearly Dominik Dijakovic, and the woman was Mercedes Martinez. And with her being kicked out of the Robert Stone brand on NXT this past week and losing that cage match to Rhea Ripley, it sure does seem like she may be on her way to Raw. Dijak, I mean, he's been rumored for Raw since, like, May. I think that was the first time I heard about him being moved or being called down to the main roster. This angle is just a mess. It just feels like a complete mess right now. If there was any importance to it, and I never bought into it as being anything that was really serious, but you look at some of the earlier angles they did many weeks ago with them taking over the show and ending the show and the chainsaws and the destruction and everything, and it just, from then to now, the volume has just been turned down by 50%. I mean, it just does not feel even as big of a deal as it did then. I didn't think it was that great then, but some people did. Now it just doesn't feel like it's much of a big deal. This was the week to try something big at the end of the night. This was the week to try something big at the end of the show to get people to tune in tomorrow night against the NFL. And they did nothing. I couldn't believe it. Of all the weeks, you want some kind of like cliffhanger ending and do something with Retribution or tease some kind of reveal finally, the next chapter in this Retribution saga. This was the time to do it and keep people wanting to tune in the following week against football and see what the hell is going to be the payoff to all this. And they did not do anything. They just had this one promo segment and that was it. Randy Orton against Keith Lee. Yes, again. Talk about Groundhog Day. They had Keith Lee beat Randy Orton at Payback. That was awesome. That was the right move. There was no need to bring this match back for a third time. Keith Lee got a win over an established star, and that established star is already challenging for the WWE title anyway, in a few weeks. Everybody wins. And actually, I have to correct myself. This was the fourth match involving these men, if you count the triple threat with Seth Rollins the week before. This was match number four. Four matches with these two in the span of 3 weeks. And this time it was another DQ win for Randy Orton, where when it was over, Keith Lee just sort of rolled out of the ring and disappeared. Another DQ win where Drew McIntyre interfered. That is now the second time that Drew McIntyre has cost Keith Lee a win. And what kind of made this worse was that Orton hit him with an RKO. He hit Lee, dropped him with the RKO, and he had him beat. I mean, when he dropped Keith Lee with an RKO in that three-way match a couple of weeks ago, he didn't pin Keith Lee. He pinned Seth Rollins. But here, he clearly had this guy beat. He was seconds away from pinning Keith Lee and getting his win back when Drew McIntyre got involved. And this now leads to a match for the first time ever in WWE. I mean, they wrestled in Evolve, but for the first time in WWE, we're going to get a match on Raw tomorrow night between Drew McIntyre and Keith Lee, which the best thing I can say about that, at least it's a fresh match that we haven't seen yet. Out of all the matches they keep running back every single week, this is a match we have not yet seen in WWE. But I look at this and I think to myself, there's really no good outcome here. Either Drew McIntyre wins, well, you know, Keith Lee put up a hell of a fight, yeah, but he still loses because Drew is the champion. And you're not going to pin your champion. I mean, that's just dumb. Keith Lee wins, which would be nice, but he's not in the title match at Clash of Champions, so you can't beat the champion. Or, the most likely scenario, we're getting a screwy finish. Now, what's the solution to this? The solution to this is to, especially if you're going to do a screwy finish, you add Keith Lee to the match at Clash of Champions. Keith Lee has no other obvious match. He's been involved with both these guys. You add Keith Lee, you make it a triple threat match at Clash of Champions. And make sure that it's Randy Orton who gets pinned again by Drew McIntyre and not Keith Lee. So that at least protects Keith Lee from a pinfall loss in a big match. And it could preserve him for a singles match for the championship later on. That is probably the best scenario out of this. But there is another alternate scenario that I would pitch to you here. And that involves retribution. While I am not the biggest fan of retribution, there is still time to pay this thing off in a way that actually is kind of compelling and kind of interesting, and maybe it actually helps get a few people over. And one of those people could be Dominik Dijakovic. Now, I don't know if Mercedes Martinez and Mia Yim and, you know, Vanessa Bourne and some of these people that have clearly been under the masks. Mia Yim did not speak, but clearly she was one of the masked people. You could just tell by the eyes on Raw last week. That doesn't mean that all of these people are going to be unmasked when the time comes. So I don't know if we're going to see Dijakovic and we're going to see Mercedes Martinez. I would think the two of them will be under the masks when the reveal happens, because it just seems like Mercedes is moving on, you know, to a different brand. And Dijakovic has been rumored for Raw anyway. I can't speak to the others. But even if it was just someone like Dijakovic, you know, the last time we saw him on TV, he was being killed by Karrion Kross on NXT while his best friend, Keith Lee, stood by and watched. Now, you know, Dijakovic did tell him, stay there, don't get involved, I don't want your help. But that was the last image we had, was this guy getting killed on TV while Keith Lee stood there and watched. So if he's got a bone to pick with Keith Lee coming to Raw, leaving him behind, then that could be Keith Lee's next feud. And that leaves Drew McIntyre alone to go off with Randy Orton for their match. And instead, Lee now starts something with Retribution and with Dijakovic. That could be another direction that you branch off into, but you got to do the reveal. The reveal, at least of Dijakovic, would have to happen on TV tomorrow night. Maybe you don't reveal every member. Maybe you reveal one member per week. One member every other week. Drag this out a little bit longer. But there's got to be some kind of reveal. There's got to be something that happens on this show tomorrow night in order to kind of kick things off. So that's another idea that I put out there. The first meeting between Kevin Owens and Aleister Black took place not in the ring. Not in the Raw ring anyway. It took place on Raw Underground, which is a ring with no ropes. Now why? Why did it happen this way? Well, don't look at me. I don't book this shit. I can't explain that to you. I mean, is the idea that, well, these guys, there's such bad blood there that it can only be settled in Raw Underground? No, you can do it on Raw. You can do a no DQ match on Raw. Does the absence of the ropes, is that, I mean, that just means that this has been taken to another level? Is that what you're implying here? There was no good reason for this to take place on Raw Underground other than to get over somebody else, which is what this whole thing was about. And let me just say this. They did this on Raw Underground. I did not watch any of this outside of the very end. I wanted to see how it ended. They split this up into multiple segments on the show. They would start fighting. Shane McMahon on speed would be like, all right, we'll come back, guys. We'll come back. We'll come back. So they would cut to something else. And then a couple of segments later, they'd come back. And they'd cut to something else. And a couple of segments later, they'd come back. So they split this up into multiple segments, which was annoying enough. But Raw Underground is a production abomination. And I cannot watch it for more than a few seconds. I refuse. Not until they stop with all the camera cuts. I can't do it. But I didn't miss much. Because it went to a no contest. Even in the underground, we get non-finishes on this show. But the whole point of this was to get over Dabba Kato. Dabba Kato, in the end, put down Kevin Owens, and he put down Aleister Black with a gigantic chokeslam. And left both guys laying. And he got some impressive height on that chokeslam to Aleister Black, I will say that. I don't know that he's a very good wrestler, I haven't seen him wrestle much, but on the chokeslam, he got some impressive height on that. But this was all just to get Dabba Kato over. And less so to resolve any issues between Kevin Owens and Aleister Black, which should be saved for the ring and not the the fighting grounds. The end of the show is the most enjoyable part of the whole thing. I wish somebody would have told me. I wish somebody would have tipped me off about this. Of course, when I'm watching live, it's hard to do that. But had I known, I would have skipped right to the end of the show. It was Murphy against Dominic Mysterio. In a street fight, Dominic walked to the ring with his entire family in tow. Ray, Angie, his mom, Aaliyah, his sister. It was a family affair. And Murphy, his whole thing was, you basically got me excommunicated from Seth Rollins' group. The Messiah doesn't want to have anything to do with me. I blame you. You're responsible for this, and now I'm going to make you pay. That was the story coming into this match. Murphy had been abandoned by Seth Rollins. He had been cast away, and he was looking for revenge on the Mysterio family. So Dominic had tried for a DDT, and Murphy launched him into the ring post 3 times in a row. And Murphy locked him up in the ropes. This was going to be the big finish. He was going to do the exact same thing to Dominic he had done weeks ago, where they took the kendo stick shots. He was tied up in the ropes. He couldn't move. He couldn't go anywhere. So he ties up Dominic in the ropes, and Murphy leaves and goes to fetch the kendo stick. And when he does, Ray grabs it away from him. Murphy's on the outside of the ring. While he is preoccupied, Angie and Aaliyah, mother and sister for Dominic, free him from the ropes. And Dominic hit what I thought was a fucking awesome move. Murphy's outside. Dominic comes sliding in with a sunset flip bomb. I think he went under the ropes. And did a sunset flip bomb, basically, sending Murphy backwards into a table that had been propped up and positioned outside over by the announce desk. And he went right through the table. That looked great. Back inside, Dominic hit a big frog splash, only got a near fall. I thought it was over, but only got a near fall. So then Ray and Dominic tied up Murphy in the ropes. And they all took turns hitting Murphy with the kendo stick. They invited Angie into the ring. They invited Aaliyah. Angie was very hesitant. Aaliyah, though, the sister, she didn't mind at all. And she starts beating on Murphy with this kendo stick. And they're all beating on Murphy with the kendo stick until finally he just verbally submits. I give up. I've had enough. He cries uncle. And Dominic wins. And the final scene of the show was all the members of the Mysterio family beating down on Murphy with this kendo stick. And again, the camera cuts were just nauseating here, but this is just what they do. That aside, I thought that was a fun way for the show to go off the air. I only wish the rest of the show could have been as fun. It had moments like the Cedric turn, which, you know, had to happen. It was inevitable. But, I mean, my God, is this show a fucking slog to sit through? With the repeat matches and the bullshit segments and the stuff that just makes you scratch your head. I didn't even mention the 24/7 stuff. To me, that is an embarrassment. At this point, it is the epitome of laziness on their part, because we have to have our resident 24/7 segment. And I love R-Truth to death. R-Truth can make almost anything work, but after a while, even that gets fucking old. There's no creativity at all. None. But they think it's funny. So we'll just keep running the same bullshit segments with Truth and Tozawa and the ninjas over and over and over again, because we are creatively bankrupt and we have nothing better to do. We can't think of a single fucking thing that these guys could be doing otherwise. I mean, I've already grown to hate the 24/7 stuff anyway. It's just complete and utter laziness. I didn't even talk about that until just now. So, the ending of the show on its own? Very good. Maybe they could have condensed the show down into 15 minutes. Then I would give it a 10 out of 10. But they're trying to go all out tomorrow night, because they're worried about football. They have a tagline for Raw now. It's called In Your Face. So we have Raw In Your Face or Up Your Ass or whatever tomorrow night. Drew McIntyre against Keith Lee. Seth Rollins and Dominic again. This time inside of a steel cage. So if you thought this issue was over, silly you. Silly you. So they're going to have a cage match. And look, Dominic has looked very good. Dominic has yet to have a bad match. I don't care what anybody says. I've seen a lot of hate for Dominic, and I don't know where it's coming from. I really don't. I don't know if it's people who just are annoyed that here comes this kid who has very little experience, and he's only on TV because of his dad, and he's taking a spot from someone else. I don't know if it's because of that, or they genuinely think that he's just not that good, but I don't see how you can watch the kid with the level of experience that he's had and think that he's bad. I mean, to me, that's just hating on the kid for no reason. And there's a lot of room for him to get better even and improve over time. But what I've seen from him so far, and yes, he's been in the ring with good workers. Murphy's a good worker. Seth Rollins is a good wrestler. He's had some good dance partners in there. Dominic Mysterio is very good. And if you don't want to admit that, then I think it's blind hatred for the kid, and I can't understand where it's coming from. He's looked very impressive in every single match he's been in. In fact, the tag team match that he was part of at the pay-per-view at Payback may have been the best match on the entire show. First or second best match on the entire show. So him having a cage match with Seth, I expect this to be another very good match. But I mean, how many of these Seth Rollins-Dominic matches are we going to see? It goes to the problem I just talked about before. At some point, you know, you gotta move on. You gotta give people different matches. One of those matches, Asuka against Mickey James. They're going to have that match for the Women's Championship, the Raw Women's title. And they're doing the champion versus champion, Raw versus SmackDown match, Cesaro and Shinsuke against the Street Profits. There's still time to do the right thing. It's not often I advocate for some kind of a non-finish, but the right thing to do would be to have an inconclusive finish or a draw and build to a unification match at Clash of Champions. And then pick your poison. Whoever you want to put the belts on, you put the belts on them and they become the traveling champions. They could work a program on Raw for a few weeks, work a program on SmackDown for a few weeks, or they could just float and have special matches from time to time, even if it's not necessarily a program. They could do that with NXT. Have the Street Profits come back to NXT for a week and have a match against, you know, Imperium or somebody. But that would be the way to go. SmackDown. I like the opening segment. I'm just going to run through some of the key things here. I like the opening segment from Friday night with Paul Heyman, Roman Reigns, or as he calls him, the Tribal Chief, and Jey Uso. This story is progressing nicely. I was enjoying it until King Corbin came out. King Corbin and Sheamus, you know. You could see again, it's the setup for the inevitable tag team match at the end of the night, which is what we got. And I also was reminded that, you know, when I saw Corbin come out, and I was reminded, you know, after that this week coming up is going to be 1 year since Baron Corbin won the King of the Ring tournament. That is 1 year of this ridiculous king gimmick with the crown and the robe. A year of this shit. Can we be done with this, please? So, yes, this did set up a tag team match for later in the night. But Jey Uso in this segment, you know, it kind of struck me as Jey Uso doesn't necessarily know what he's in for here. Jey Uso still had not yet picked up on the fact that Roman Reigns was not as friendly with him as he would like to think that he is being. Although he was grateful for the opportunity for him to be in that match where he earned the right to challenge Roman at the pay-per-view. By the end of the night, though, I think he was kind of picking up on what's going on here. We had AJ Styles and Jeff Hardy for the Intercontinental Championship. Disqualification came when Sami Zayn interfered. He yanked AJ off the apron. Sami is still a thorn in their side, still claiming to be the real Intercontinental Champion. And obviously we are headed for a triple threat at the pay-per-view, even though it has not yet been announced. Jeff Hardy did an interview with BT Sport, and he talked about wanting to bring his alter ego from TNA, Willow, to WWE for a feud with the Fiend Bray Wyatt. Ah, yes. Willow. You all remember Willow, don't you? If not, let me refresh your memory with this gem from SoundOff 327. Jeff Hardy is being beaten down with a metal object, and instead of just, you know, screaming like Jeff Hardy normally would to sell the fact that, shit, that hurts, he's doing his weird Willow screams. I mean, you want to see a Willow impression? Here's my Willow impression. Willow is being beaten down by the metal object because Willow sucks! So now Jeff Hardy wants to bring Willow into the Firefly Funhouse. Of all the places for Willow to be, the Funhouse seems like it would be an appropriate place. And I have pitched a program already between Jeff and The Fiend anyway, although when I did that, I figured it would be for the championship. I had no idea they were going to take the belt off The Fiend a week later. But Jeff says that it's a dream. It's a dream of his to bring Willow to the WWE universe. Well, you know, hey, just keep any metal objects away from him. So we may have to bring back the Willow voice soon. AJ Styles and Joseph Park, they made an appearance on Talking Smack, which went up on the network yesterday. I did see it. And, you know, I did not know this. I did not know this until Joseph Park mentioned this, but he claimed that his great-grandfather, Jebediah Park, once fought George Hackenschmidt in a bare-knuckle fight. And he almost won, too. He almost won. As soon as the name Jebediah came out of his mouth, AJ Styles could not control his laughter. He busted out. He tried to save it. He tried to play it off cool. He tried to keep it together. But he failed. Why is this man not on television every week? Why is Joseph Park not on television every single week? I don't want him on television once every 6 weeks. He needs to be a recurring character on this show. He is real comedy, not that 24/7 fourth comedy bullshit they do on Mondays. This guy needs a presence on the show every week. In fact, I would go so far as to say that you might even want to consider giving him his own talk show segment. Just to give him something to do on the show. But I like the chemistry with him and AJ. Like, he's AJ's lawyer, statistician, lackey, whatever you want to call him. He's fantastic. That character is just fantastic. Bayley. Bayley came out for a promo. She brought a chair with her to the ring, maybe the same chair that she used on Sasha Banks the week before to beat down her best friend. And she opened the chair up in the ring and she sat down on the chair to cut her promo in the center of the ring, Eddie Guerrero style, the week after he turned on Rey Mysterio. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but Sasha Banks, everybody knows Sasha Banks is a gigantic Eddie Guerrero fan. If Eddie were still around, if I were Vicky, I would be worried. She's a gigantic Eddie Guerrero fan. So if this was a subtle dig at Sasha Banks, I like that. And I think it was. I think it probably was intentional. But Bayley said that she knew Sasha was at home watching, and she said that Sasha thought that she was naive. She said that Sasha was waiting for the right time to strike and to attack her, which is probably true. She said Sasha kept her close and that she used her to become two belt Banks. She said that she was using Sasha as well. Thanks to you, I am the longest reigning SmackDown Women's Champion. But after last week, you are completely useless to me. And I thought that her promo here was, those were the key lines, but I thought her promo was very good. As she was leaving, Nikki Cross was coming up for the next match, and Bayley attacked her and hit her with a chair. And that should have been a giveaway about how this next match was going to end. It was a number one contender's fatal four-way match. The winner would challenge Bayley for the championship at Clash of Champions. We had Nikki Cross, Lacey Evans, Tamina. Why? I don't know. But Tamina and Alexa Bliss. And the big spot here was Nikki had wiped out Lacey and Tamina outside the ring. And Alexa was picking her up very slowly, and then she set her up for Sister Abigail. Bray Wyatt's move. And she hit Sister Abigail to Nikki Cross on the floor. Alexa looked up. She looked like she was in a trance. When they came back from break, she was gone. She had left. It was now a triple threat match. And in the end, Nikki Cross did manage to pick up a win. She rolled up Tamina for the win. So that means Nikki Cross is going to get the match with Bayley for the SmackDown Women's Championship. Only a couple of months removed from what? I mean, it was probably three matches that Nikki Cross had with Bayley already for the SmackDown Women's Championship. All of which, by the way, she failed to win the title. Now we're back to this match again. I mean, I'll say this, of all the options in that match, Tamina, Lacey, which we've also seen, you know, Nikki Cross, probably the best choice of the three, once Alexa bailed. Alexa's doing her own thing. She's doing her own story right now. She didn't have to win this. So probably the best option, but my God, I mean, we're back to this match again. So what do they do with Clash of Champions? Either they bring Sasha back at the pay-per-view to interfere, or Alexa Bliss gets involved and she lapses into a trance-like state and she winds up costing Nikki Cross the match, and then Nikki Cross can go on to feud with Alexa Bliss. Yeah, WWE, originally the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view was going to take place November 1st, so we were going to get two pay-per-views in the month of November, Hell in a Cell and Survivor Series. WWE has moved the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view back a week, so it will now be taking place October 25th, so that will be the date of Hell in a Cell. You know, I could see where it would be appealing to them to want to bring back Sasha, not keep her off TV for months, and go right into a Hell in a Cell match between her and Bayley. But I think it would be probably a very good match. Sasha had an excellent Hell in a Cell match with Becky Lynch last year. The only saving grace of that awful night. But I just don't like the idea that in the first match you do with these two, I mean their first match in years, you go right to the Hell in a Cell stipulation. Because you know it's not going to be the end of the feud. There will likely be multiple matches. And I just, the idea that the very first one is going to be Hell in a Cell, it just feels so ass backwards to me. Because Hell in a Cell should be the blow-off. If anything, right, it should be the blow-off to a big feud, not the first match. But after what Bayley did to Sasha, Sasha has this reason to want revenge and to want to take a chair and wrap it around her throat. And so why not put them in Hell in a Cell? I could see the appeal. I could see them wanting to do that. I'm just not enamored with the idea. I would much rather they wait. I would just much rather they wait. I mean, the injury angle they did could keep Sasha off TV for a few months. But it is a long time to wait. If you want to bring her back at the Rumble or have her win the Royal Rumble and then do the first match at Mania, it is a long ways away. But I just look at it and go, sell the injury. Put some shine on some other people for a few months. All you need is two people. I had said Mandy and Naomi, but I'll get to Mandy in a second and why that doesn't look like it's going to happen. And that could kind of bridge the gap until Sasha is ready to come back. But most likely, you know, knowing WWE, they'll have Sasha back within a few weeks looking for revenge. And we'll probably get the first match next month. But again, I am not sold on that idea. I just wish that they would... They've waited so long. They've taken their time with this for so long that I kind of think, what's a few more months before you get Sasha back and then you really build it up the right way? And, you know, look, I will even say this, and some people are going to disagree with this. It's very, very early to know what the WrestleMania matches and main events are going to be. Most likely, it will involve Roman Reigns, probably defending the Universal Championship. And it could be against anybody. It could be Roman defending the Universal title against The Fiend. It could be Roman defending the Universal title against Brock Lesnar, if Brock Lesnar comes back. It could be Roman and Daniel Bryan, which is a ready-made feud just waiting whenever Bryan is ready to come back. There is a very good chance that Roman Reigns will headline WrestleMania next year. But you could absolutely headline WrestleMania next year with Sasha Banks and Bayley. And some people are going to laugh. Oh, what a silly idea. A silly idea. It's really not. It's really not. Don't be stupid. Don't be stupid. Think about it. This is a big match. First match between these two is going to be a big match. And probably the second and third match will be pretty big too. But that first match is going to be a big deal. And I think by then, certainly, people are going to be dying to see this belt off of Bayley already. Sasha will come back. She'll be a popular babyface. It sucks that we can't get people in the buildings and we have the virtual fans, but what are you going to do? Just like Roman Reigns. We finally got the Roman Reigns heel turn after 5 years, and it came when no fans are in the building. That part of it sucks. But what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You're going to hold everything off until people are back in the buildings? It could be months. Can't do that. You got to move on. You got to keep things going. But I think if you play your cards right, Sasha Banks and Bayley, it's early. I could change my mind. I mean, they change their minds every fucking week. How come I can't change my mind? Talk to me in January and February, and let's see at that point what the card kind of starts to look like for WrestleMania. But you could absolutely have Sasha Banks and Bayley in the conversation as a WrestleMania main event for WrestleMania 37 next year. Absolutely. That's how long this has been built up for. That's the story that's there. And I think the match they have, look, I can't sit here and tell you that they would be able to recapture the magic of the match they had in Brooklyn 5 years ago. It would be impossible to capture the magic of that match without people in the crowd. Impossible. You can't do it. So maybe it wouldn't be as good or as, you know, just as fantastic as that match was. But if they could even recapture some of the magic of that match and just go out there and do what they do best against each other, they're going to be extra motivated to go out there and probably just tear the fucking house down. I absolutely could see that as being a WrestleMania main event that you would consider. At least consider the idea. At least consider the idea. Absolutely, without question, that could be a WrestleMania main event match. And I just hate the idea that you've come this far after as long as it's been going on for, that you would do anything that could potentially jeopardize that. Just save it for the right moment. We had another vignette with the blonde woman whose face we have not seen. We've seen her legs, her feet, her back, her arms. She's got the fur coat on, but we have not heard her voice. We have not seen her face. I've seen a lot of scuttlebutt that it's this person, it's that person, it's Carmella. I mean, I'm almost positive that's who it is. So I don't know if that's just her getting a complete redo or... I mean, we've seen Carmella. I feel like we've seen Carmella before with the fur coat. So, I mean, that's not that radical of a departure for her character. It just seems very odd to me, unless they are repackaging her in some way, that they would do these vignettes for someone who's already been established on TV for years. It just seems very strange to me. But there's certain characteristics about her. I'm almost positive it's Carmella in these videos. Miz and Morrison again were foiled by Otis in their attempt to steal the Money in the Bank contract. Miz already told Morrison last week, it doesn't work that way. You can't just steal it and own it and it's yours. But now he says he went and talked to his lawyer, and his lawyer told him that every contract has loopholes in it, so if you can get a copy of that contract, if you can get possession of that contract and give it to me, I will look this thing over and I'm sure I could find some kind of loophole. Well, they stole Otis's lunchbox because that's where it was the week before, but this time the contract was not inside. It was an apple core. So Miz said that that's it. I'm calling it a favor. Enough of this crap. And as we learned on Talking Smack, that favor turned out to be that Miz made a phone call to some higher up, whether it's in WWE or USA Network or wherever. And he has had Mandy Rose traded from SmackDown to Monday Night Raw. Mandy Rose is now officially a member of the Monday Night Raw roster, thus splitting her away from Otis. So maybe this ends up being their way of getting the briefcase away from Otis. If she, you know, if Otis offers the contract to Miz and Morrison in exchange for bringing Mandy back to SmackDown, they could do that. I mean, the problem I see with that is there is really no good solution here. You know, you put the Money in the Bank contract. I like Otis and all, but you put the Money in the Bank contract on a comedy guy. I mean, that's really what you did. And they did that with Damian Sandow many years ago. And people were very upset when Damian Sandow didn't beat John Cena. Damian Sandow was a comedy character. Damian Sandow was not going to beat John Cena. I think Cody was supposed to win the Money in the Bank. If Cody is to be believed, I'm almost positive I've heard him tell the story that he was told he was going to win, and then they went with Sandow instead. I think that was the Money in the Bank in Philadelphia. If it was, that was the one I was at. I think that was the year. But when you put your Money in the Bank contract on a mid-card comedy character, you run into some issues. Because unless your plan is to elevate this guy and put the belt on him, or at least pick somebody who people could believe could win the championship, there isn't a single person alive who will believe that Otis is going to beat Roman Reigns to become the Universal Champion, or that Otis would have beaten The Fiend to become the Universal Champion. And that's the position they've now put themselves in. And likewise, if he had been traded to Raw, and you got Drew McIntyre there, I mean, nobody is going to buy into that. Which is why I started pitching with Mandy and Sonya the whole concept when they were going to do the hair match of, he uses his briefcase as a way to save Mandy's hair. And Sonya then owns the briefcase, and you can put, at least then you're going to push somebody with it as a star in the women's division. That was my whole mentality in trying to come up with an idea like that. So here we are again trying to figure out, well, how are they going to get the briefcase off of Otis or away from Otis? Or maybe he'll put it up in a match. Maybe that's the end game here. Money in the Bank contract is going to be up for grabs in a match. Miz and Morrison, yeah, I don't know if it's a handicap match or what, triple threat match maybe. Miz and Morrison are fighting for it. You got the contract hanging above the ring. You could do that. But let's say you get the contract away from Otis. You're going to put the contract with Miz? You're going to put the contract with Morrison? I like John Morrison as a wrestler. I think that he could be doing more than what he's doing with Miz. I could see John Morrison as a perfectly acceptable intercontinental champion. John Morrison is another one. I cannot believe that he will cash in and win the Universal Championship from Roman Reigns. It's not going to happen. So even if they get the briefcase, are we really in a better position than we were with Otis? So I don't know where they're going with this. But as I look at this and I look at the different options that they would have, I don't see a lot of good answers and a lot of good solutions to this. It almost feels like the money in the bank is just kind of wasted. It's like a lost cause this year. We had the Firefly Funhouse. He had promised a new character on the show. Someone new was joining the Funhouse, and it was going to be Pasquale, the persevering parrot. Unfortunately, when he opened the box, the parrot was dead because he forgot to poke holes in the box so it could breathe. Well, you know, it happens. So he threw the box away, and Vince McMahon, puppet Vince McMahon, showed up. He was very upset with Bray for killing the parrot and just upset with him in general. And so he introduced a new special advisor, puppet, to the Firefly Funhouse. The Wobbly Walrus, which is a name that WWE, I read about the other day. The day before, I had read that WWE was trademarking the name, so we knew they were going to use it for... I knew it was going to be used for Paul Heyman. Once I heard Wobbly Walrus, I knew it had something to do with Heyman, because they've called him the Walrus on TV before. And he wobbles when he walks. He weebles and wobbles when he walks. Like a penguin. Lost my shit at the first one-night stand show back in 2005. After Paul Heyman looked up at the WWF guys up in the balcony at Hammerstein. And you had all the guy, Bischoff was up there, Coachman, Edge, JBL, Kurt Angle. And he's cutting that shoot promo. And he goes to leave. And as Heyman is leaving and he's walking down the aisle, he's waddling back and forth. And they very quickly cut to Eric Bischoff up in the balcony. He had a beer in his hand. And they cut away really, really quickly, but Bischoff starts to, like, wobble. He starts to, like, you know, wobble back and forth. Lost my shit, because he does. He wobbles when he walks. So anyway, that was the big puppet reveal here in the Funhouse. Wobbly Walrus, who they need subtitles for because he talks like a walrus, so you can barely understand what he's saying, but it's basically a takeoff on Paul Heyman. And Vince McMahon said it's such good shit, which they censored. And Bray looked into the camera like Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone and did the oh no pose. And we got our first to be continued message at the end of the Firefly Funhouse. At least they're doing something different with the Funhouse. That I like. I enjoy that. I still enjoy the Funhouse ones. The Funhouse segments. For a while, they were using a different set. They literally were just in the back. And it was very boring and bland. And now it looks like they're back to the traditional set that they were using in the beginning for the Funhouse. And now they're expanding it and introducing other characters. And I still enjoy it. Roman Reigns and Jey Uso against King Corbin and Sheamus. Roman Reigns did not come out. And Jey got attacked early by the heels. And it was mostly a handicap match until late when Sheamus was getting ready to hit the brogue kick. When all of a sudden Roman's theme music hits and... just like at Payback, when he took his time, he came out at the very end of the match. Roman, you know, he doesn't like working too much. He just wants to come out and kind of get the pin and go home. So he comes down to the ring and tags himself in. And he hits a spear on Sheamus. And gets the win for his team. And the two of them, Reigns and Uso, they're posing up on the stage. And Reigns is kind of glaring at him when Jey picked up his hand. And we had a very tense kind of stare down here with both guys standing next to each other on stage. So this story is progressing nicely. Again, Jey Uso is going to be murdered at Clash of Champions, I'm sorry to say. But I like what they're doing so far with Heyman and Reigns. Reigns, he doesn't talk much. He talks a little bit, but he leaves most of the talking to Heyman. Reigns just kind of standing there as the silent destroyer. I mean, he comes across as more of a badass than he ever did when he was booked as a babyface. So all he has to do is stand there, mean mug. I mean, they'll have to add layers to the character over, you know, over time. It's It's been a few weeks, though. He doesn't have to do much right now. But at the pay-per-view, I'm curious if it's going to be a competitive match, like they go out there and have a 15-minute long competitive match, or if it doesn't go that long and Roman just absolutely destroys this guy. Maybe Jimmy Uso will show up. I don't know how far along Jimmy Uso is in his rehab from his injury. I think it was a knee injury. Was it an ACL? I don't remember if it was an ACL or not. So he may not be ready to come back yet, but I suspect that we're going to see a much more violent side of Roman Reigns at Clash of Champions. Then the question becomes, who challenges him at Hell in a Cell? I mean, it's going to be 1 year after we had The Fiend in there with Seth Rollins, so are we going to go from one Shield member to another with The Fiend inside the cell? Or can they put somebody else in there? Where's Braun Strowman been? They took Braun Strowman off TV. I don't know. I'd like to see Reigns continue this, though, against guys that he hasn't wrestled before. Maybe next time it's Matt Riddle. I don't know. But I like what they're doing so far. The Super Tuesday rating for NXT was very good. The show's third highest viewership of the year. Still down a little bit from the week before, though. So if the idea was that the finish of the Iron Man match, the non-finish in the Iron Man match, the tie, would bring people back or bring more people in. I mean, they kept most of those people, but they didn't bring anyone new in. 838,000 viewers down in every demo from the week before, except for one. I'll give you one guess as to what demo that was. 50 plus. Up more than 7%. The boomers love their NXT. The boomers love their NXT. And so it's like, you know, to them, it's like NXT is like the Fox News of wrestling to the boomers. The numbers are just, I mean, you look at the chart for some of those news shows. My God. Holy shit. I mean, it's like, this is like their version of Fox wrestling-wise. That's what NXT is to a lot of these people. And so it only reiterated my point that NXT needs to move to Tuesdays until the numbers came in for Dynamite. And with that died any possibility of NXT moving to Tuesdays. I mean, USA Network can still make it happen. USA Network, what the network wants, the network gets, whether Vince McMahon likes it or not. The network wanted 3 hours, Monday Night Raw is 3 hours. So if USA really pushed for it, they would move the show. If they really like it when NXT is on its own night and they can chart higher up, right? It's on them. It's up to them if they want it. But if you leave that decision or you get input from Vince McMahon about whether or not they should make this move, if it is a Vince McMahon call, there is no chance in hell that NXT now moves to Tuesdays, or any other night for that matter. AEW Dynamite, which was back in its normal slot on Wednesdays, the first show since the All Out pay-per-view, was back over 1 million live viewers for the first time all year. This was their third highest rated Dynamite of all time after the very first two episodes of Dynamite from last October. With the high point coming for the main event, Brody Lee against Dustin Rhodes for the TNT title, 1,066,000 viewers. Interestingly, on NXT, Rhea Ripley and Mercedes Martinez, their cage match, which went on last, that headlined the show, did better in overall viewers than the opener, which was for the NXT Championship with Finn Balor and Adam Cole. And that could just be people just out of habit tuning in to see what the main event was going to be. But that match did better than the NXT Championship match. But the two shows combined, even though they were on different nights, they combined for 1.8 million viewers, which is more than what Monday Night Raw did this week. Monday Night Raw was 1.7 and change. So these two shows combined for 1.8. And, you know, look, Raw is the established show. And so on its own, it still does, you know, better than any other single show does. But this would not have been the case months ago. This is more, I think, a reflection of how depleted the Raw ratings have gotten year over year. Go back a year ago, you'll see the numbers are higher. A year before that, the numbers are higher. It's just the continuing of a pattern. But I was happy to see that. I was happy to see the growth for both shows. Unfortunately for AEW, their big pitch for this week's show, which has already been taped, is that it may or may not air on Wednesday night. I don't know that I've ever seen that before, where a wrestling promotion is just honest and says, look, we're going to be honest with you. We don't know when the show is going to air. So just follow us on social media and we'll let you know. you know, or check your local listings and we'll let you know. Not something you want to tell your audience coming off your biggest TV viewership all year. The Lakers finished off the Rockets last night. So as I understand it, and I could be wrong here, maybe I'm misunderstanding the whole schedule, but if the Denver Nuggets win their game today, which is probably already going to be over by the time many of you listen to this, if the Denver Nuggets win their game today against the Clippers, then Dynamite will air on Wednesday night in its normal slot. And I will be streaming on Wednesday night for Dynamite, not for NXT. So that game, as I am recording this, starts in about an hour. So if the Clippers win, then I think Dynamite airs on Thursday. And then you'll get two streams from me this week. One after NXT on Wednesday, and then another one on Thursday after Dynamite. So that is the plan as of now. Rusev is All Elite. He made his debut on Wednesday as Miro. His real name is Miroslav, so he calls himself Miro. He is the best man for Kip Sabian's upcoming nuptials to Penelope Ford. Sabian is out there every week now promoting his Twitch channel. And Miro is a big star on Twitch. He thinks he's a big shot on there. And so I guess that's why he would be chosen as the best man from one Twitch guy to another. On his YouTube stream last night, Chris Jericho does a stream on Saturday nights every week on YouTube. Jericho described the best man thing that Miro is doing as something very similar to what Mr. Perfect did. When Mr. Perfect came into WWE, he had all these vignettes showing that he's perfect at everything he does. He's the perfect bowler. He's the perfect, you know, baseball player, basketball. He can shoot hoops and get nothing but net. He can throw a football from one end of the field and catch his own pass, right? All these vignettes with Mr. Perfect. I don't know if they're going to do vignettes for Miro. But he said the idea is that he is the best. He's the best man. Not just with the wedding, but he's going to be the best at everything he does. So it's similar to the Mr. Perfect thing in that way. Look, it's going to allow him... It is a weird place to put him. You know, Kip Sabian was a mid-card comedy guy, not getting much in the way of TV time. He was kind of like an afterthought. Rusev was a much bigger star than Kip Sabian was, and so to put him with him is a little weird, but it'll allow him to be funny and show off more of his personality with Sabian, and then branch off into something bigger. Now, some people didn't like my criticism from the Dynamite stream this week of his promo. The first words out of Rusev's mouth, out of Miro's mouth, were about the 10 years that he spent in the WWE system. He never named WWE, but obviously he was talking about them, and the 10 years there, the glass ceiling, the brass ring that we've heard from how many other wrestlers? And all these wrestlers that were miserable working for Vince McMahon, who felt held down, not able to realize their full potential, or told that you're not really over, even though the fans are cheering for them and the fans are chanting their catchphrase, right? All these guys who had every right, by the way, to feel this way. But we've heard these interviews and these comments and promos before about glass ceilings and brass rings being held down and little jabs and little digs. Jericho said the brass ring line came from him. He suggested it, which doesn't surprise me. Jericho has been taking nonstop shots at WWE. So he said that line comes from him. And he said Miro couldn't believe it. He couldn't believe that he would be allowed to say it. He goes, is that okay for me to talk about this stuff? And Jericho's like, yeah, you can talk about whatever you want. So Jericho's the one who actually pushed him to go ahead and say these things. All I said was, leave that for the inevitable Talk is Jericho podcast that you know is coming. It's just a matter of time. Everybody ends up doing Talk is Jericho, right? Brody Lee did it. FTR did it. Rusev's going to do it too. Save it for the podcast. Save it for Twitch. Save it for social media. The people already know who you are. They know where you're from. They know what you're all about. And the ones maybe that don't know that you're from WWE, who gives a shit? You're not here to talk about WWE. You're here to establish an identity for yourself on this show. I mean, he got a great reaction from the people who were there. They had 500 people or 1,000 people, whatever it was, in the building in Daly's Place spread out on Wednesday. Clearly, people knew who he was. This audience that watches this show, they know who he is. This is the audience that they cater to. They all know who this guy is already. The money line came at the end. My name is Miro, and I'm All Elite. That was perfect. That was the perfect finale to that promo. But I don't want to hear about this glass ceiling in WWE stuff anymore on AEW television or Impact or anywhere else. We get it. They missed you. They missed the boat with you. They misused you. But with these types of promos, it's the law of diminishing returns. Some people probably still get a rise out of it. They love it. They love taking shots, companies taking shots at each other. And I do too in some instances. It could be clever, it could be funny, but when it's done to death, or it feels like everybody coming from one place is doing the same thing in the other, it gets old. It gets old. I had some people tell me, well, you do realize that they did these types of promos all the time during the Monday Night War. Well, no, I didn't know. I started watching wrestling in 2010, so fuck me, I didn't know that. Gee, thanks for educating me. Of course I fucking knew. I lived through it. I saw all of it. Back then, it was edgy, because we hadn't seen stuff like that before on television. Wrestling was hot, guys were jumping back and forth constantly, more so than now. It was a lot of fun to watch. It was a fun time to be a wrestling fan. But that was 23 years ago. After 23 years, it gets old. There's a lot of things I liked 23 years ago that I don't like today. There's a lot of people I liked 23 years ago who I don't like today. You know who you are. This is his chance now to sink or swim. And to show a side of him that we never got to see in WWE. Brody Lee has done that to a degree. I mean, some people aren't fans of Brody Lee, but Brody Lee is leading his own faction. He's a leader and not a follower like he was with the Wyatt family. He is the TNT champion now. So they're going with him in that role. FTR, they just won the AEW tag team titles. They're setting up for the big program with the Young Bucks. So some of the ex-WWE guys who were unhappy have found success in AEW. I think Miro will too. After the show, he posted a YouTube video from his phone. He was backstage in front of a trailer. He had just come off the high, I think, of everything, and he just wanted to record a quick 3-minute video. And he said that everything he said out there were his true feelings. He meant every word that he said. Look, I'm glad he was able to get it off his chest, but now it's time to put WWE in the rearview mirror where they belong and show the fans what they missed out on in the other company. Sean Ross Sapp reports from Fightful.com that Miro's deal allows him to work dates for New Japan if he wants to, so long as they don't conflict, I assume, with any of his AEW obligations. So maybe like a one-off show here and there. I can't see them allowing him to go there for, you know, like a G1 type thing where he's going to be gone for weeks on end. But apparently it does allow for him to work there. There's a lot of appealing opponents for him, I feel like, in AEW. Darby Allin, Jungle Boy, some of the smaller guys like Darby Allin and Jungle Boy. Bigger guys like Lance Archer, somebody like a Jon Moxley, even Kenny Omega, Pentagon, Phoenix. These are all people that I would like to see him in the ring with, mixing it up with, who I think he might have good chemistry with. Lots of matches we haven't seen before. Same with New Japan. You could pick any number of guys in New Japan for him to get in the ring with, and I think it would be fun. It would be fun to see. AEW has loaded up this week's show. Best Friends against Santana and Ortiz in a parking lot fight. Thunder Rosa defends the NWA Women's Championship against Ivelisse. Thunder Rosa is said to be working on a per-date deal with AEW, which is great because that means we have not seen the last of her. I think that's awesome. FTR against Jurassic Express, non-title. If they win, then the Dinosaurs will get their championship match. Hangman Page against Frankie Kazarian, Jericho and Jake Hager take on Private Party. Chris Jericho is now going off into the tag team ranks. He's going to try something different. Already lost to Orange Cassidy. He's been the AEW champion. Jericho said that they were trying to still to work something out with Mike Tyson. It's going a lot slower than they had hoped. That's why they extended the feud with Orange Cassidy, and that's why Chris Jericho now is going into the tag team ranks. They wanted to build something with him and Tyson. Tyson still has a fight that he's doing. It was supposed to be this month, and I think it got pushed back to November. I don't see Mike Tyson doing a damn thing, wrestling-wise, before then, so I don't know that it's ever going to happen. Jericho has it in his head that it still might. They're still talking. There's discussions going on. But in the meantime, now he's going to take a stab at the tag team division. I don't care much for Hager. He doesn't do anything for me. But Jericho doing the tag team thing for a while, I guess it opens up some new matches for him. And on the anniversary episode of Dynamite, October 14th, Jon Moxley will defend the AEW Championship against the winner of the Casino Battle Royal, Lance Archer. Even though Eddie Kingston pointed out correctly on TV this week that he was never eliminated from the Battle Royal, which is what I pointed out during my review of the pay-per-view, Archer is going to get the next shot on October 14th. Now, over on the NXT side, Finn Balor beat Adam Cole to become only the third NXT champion in history to repeat, joining Samoa Joe and Shinsuke Nakamura. It was the right call. Now they could do Ciampa and Balor. Ciampa and Balor. I don't know what I was saying there. They could do those two for the championship if Karrion Kross is not going to be ready for a while yet. And if he is able to come back sooner, then Balor keeps the belt warm for Karrion Kross until he does, and they do Balor against Kross. Balor also gave an interview to the Metro UK website, and he talked about why, in his view, the demon character didn't really work in WWE. We have not seen him use that demon character in a very long time. He said, I think the return to NXT has helped me to protect not only Finn and the Prince, but my own integrity and also the demon. I feel like we kind of use it as a bit of a crutch. As cool as the demon was, it was making Finn less cool in the sense that Finn would get his ass kicked and then the demon would come and save the day. I'm sure we'll get back to the demon at some point against Braun Strowman, the demon against Bray Wyatt, the demon against Brock Lesnar. But there's a time and a place for that, and right now I am very much focused on NXT. I think they did a poor job of explaining why the demon would show up when he did. Now, like, why wouldn't the demon have showed up for the match against Brock Lesnar at the Royal Rumble? It's like Balor said, a lot of times it was just Finn can't win. He can't get the job done on his own. So he'll have to just dust off the demon. And he's right. It does make him look less cool. It makes him look weak. So when they bring the character back, there should be a purpose to it. If he was wrestling the Fiend, the story is very simple. He wants to fight evil with evil. And yeah, there's a pre-existing issue there with the two of them when the Fiend debuted and beat Balor, but that could be the story. If he was feuding with somebody else and they had done something, let's say, really sinister to Finn, like a big injury angle or something, they really did something awful to him. You know, Finn brings out the demon, kind of like Bruce Banner would bring out the Hulk, where, I mean, he doesn't necessarily bring him out. That's not the best way to phrase that, but you make him angry. You make him angry. And you don't want to make Finn angry. You're going to get the sharp edge of the stick if you make Finn angry. And you save the demon for those rare occasions. I would not book the demon on TV more than twice a year. That would be my absolute max for using that character on TV. And he only comes out for matches. He does not come out in the ring for a promo or even an appearance. Twice a year would be the max that I would use the demon character on TV. You have to make people want to see it. You have to make it mean something, and you have to make people want to see it. The other thing about the demon character that did not work, and I brought this up many times on this podcast, is that aside from the paint, aside from the body paint and the face paint, there was nothing that differentiated Finn Balor from Demon Balor once the bell rang. Once the bell rang and the match started, they were the same. In every way. The way they acted, the way the moves, I mean, the way he wrestled, everything was exactly the same. You got to do something different. You got to make him faster. You got to make the moves more impactful, or, you know, change to a different finishing move or add another move. Something has to be different. There's got to be something that differentiates Finn from the demon. You know, when you make Finn mad, he comes back as the demon and he wrestles like at Sushi Onita. I don't know. I mean, or New Jack. I mean, he's got to really scare people. He's got to really scare people. We want to see the new Jack version of Finn Balor. That's what the demon should be. That at least would differentiate him from what we're used to see. I don't know if you could do a PG version of New Jack. That's why New Jack never went to WWE. Although WWE, he never went there because they weren't crazy enough to sign his ass. But that's kind of the idea. That's what they need to do when they bring the demon back. This week in wrestling history, I resurrected that segment last week after a long layoff. There's a lot of big events in wrestling history that happen each week, and I find myself wanting to talk about them, and I said, well, this is the perfect time to bring back this segment and talk about not everything, but some of the key events that happened that people may not be talking about, or maybe in some cases they are. 29 years ago this week, on September 9th, 1991, Ric Flair made his WWF debut in two places at once. He wrestled at a television taping in Ottawa, Ontario. This was the night they shot that angle where he instigated Roddy Piper at the announce desk. Piper was doing commentary with Vince McMahon and Randy Savage, and he just wanted to be left alone. He was trying to be on his best behavior. He didn't want to cause any trouble. Flair was coming out for what I think was his second match of the night, which never happened, because he moseyed on over to the announce desk and he was pushing Piper. He smacked the headset off his head. Piper stood up. He got in his face. He ended up hitting him with the belt. Big brawl broke out. Officials came out. And it saw Vince McMahon throw his headset down to go down below and try to calm things down. And Roddy Piper accidentally clobbered Vince McMahon from behind with a wooden chair. Smashed the chair right across his back. Broke it. Broke the chair across his back. One of the earliest bumps that Vince McMahon ever took on TV. Not the earliest bump. I can swear I remember, and I could not for the life of me find it or remember what it was. Maybe somebody listening will. I remember years ago watching it on YouTube. It was a clip from a segment. Could have been early 80s. I'm going to say late 70s. I'm going to say it was late 70s. There was some kind of angle that took place that involved Vince McMahon taking what I believe that would have been his first bump. I just don't remember what it was. The point is, it was very rare. You never saw Vince McMahon getting physical, getting beaten up or assaulted in any way. It became commonplace in the Attitude Era. But back then, that was different. And a lot of people didn't know that Vince McMahon was the owner. They just thought that, oh my God, they beat up announcer Vince McMahon. We had never seen that before. But Flair, you know, came into the company and he took the big gold belt with him from the NWA. This was after he was fired from WCW after a disagreement with Jim Herd. Or you know, if you hear Flair tell the story, he basically told Herd, I'm not coming in. They had been talking about a contract renewal for a few months. And I don't know exactly what caused Herd to either change his mind or go back on things. But Flair was like, well, look, if I don't have a new contract, then I'm not showing up. You know, we could work something out where you want to get the belt. You know, Herd said, well, then put the belt. I'm going to send somebody to your home to get the belt. And Flair was like, well, you could do whatever you want, but I put down a $25,000 deposit on this belt. I'm sure Jim Herd didn't realize that's the way it worked back then with the NWA. And so if you want to pay me my $25,000 back, plus I think he said it was like 10 years worth of interest, you can have your belt. And that's when Jim Herd said, fuck you. And that was the end of the conversation. So Flair, in his mind, he had the belt. He had possession of the belt. He owned the belt. And the first call he made was to Vince McMahon. He said, hey, Vince said, so, you coming in for real this time? Because they had conversations previously. Flair almost came into WWE in 1988. Flair almost came into the company in 88. He would have come in to challenge Randy Savage for the championship at SummerSlam in 88. And he ended up, I don't know if he got cold feet, but however you want to describe it, he just opted to stay. He opted not to leave. I guess he got cold feet. So now Vince was like, are you really coming in this time? And Flair said, not only am I coming in, if you'll have me, but I've got the belt. And Vince said, really? He says, yep. He said, put it in the mail to me. That's what he did. He put the belt in the mail, or he FedExed it. And we saw Bobby Heenan tease for weeks. He would show the big gold belt on TV, and he was teasing that Flair was coming in. And what happened after a period of time, we got to see the big gold belt on WWE television. After a while, they started video distorting it, and they gave Flair an old WWF tag belt. And you could still see around the distortion. I mean, you could tell what it was. That was when, I guess, they reached a settlement, and he was no longer allowed to use the belt, or maybe he didn't have possession of it anymore. But in any event, while that angle was going on at the tapings, that very same day, Ric Flair made his television debut on Primetime Wrestling. Bobby Heenan introduced him. Bobby had been showing that belt off for weeks. Bobby was going to be his manager. But he didn't last very long. He couldn't handle Rick, and so they had Mr. Perfect become his executive consultant while Perfect was out with his back injury. And a great little group was born. The Ric Flair, Mr. Perfect, Bobby Heenan faction, if you want to call them that. The consultancy. 19 years ago this week, on September 10th, 2001, the final ever edition of Raw is War aired on USA. The very next day, two planes crashed into the World Trade Center and one into the Pentagon. And the following Monday, they dropped the war part of the name of the show, and it's been that way ever since. 3 days later, SmackDown aired live, becoming the first live sporting event of any kind to be held after the 9/11 attacks. You know, I can't believe it's been 19 years. It really is one of those events that, you know, if you live through it at the time, meaning you can just remember where you were on that day, everybody remembers. I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing. Everybody's got a story about what happened that day. I can't believe it's been almost 20 years since then. 20 years! It's insane. But SmackDown aired live 3 days later. This was the show where Stephanie McMahon, in one of the most tone-deaf, narcissistic speeches that I have ever seen, still to this day, in saying a few words about the attack. In fact, she might have been the first person they cut to for one of these interviews that they did throughout the show. They cut to her, and she spent half of her speech, and she was only talking for maybe, I don't know, 45 seconds, maybe a minute. And she spent half of her speech comparing what America was going through. The buildings in New York were still smoldering. Almost 3,000 people dead. And she's comparing it to what her family went through when the United States government came after her family during the whole steroid trial and steroid investigation. There is a reason that this segment gets mocked as much as it does. The dark match that night saw The Rock, as the WCW champion, beat Stone Cold Steve Austin, who was the WWF champion. Those were very strange times indeed. 15 years ago this week, on September 11th, 2005, what a lot of people would call the greatest match in the history of Impact Wrestling took place at the TNA Unbreakable pay-per-view, a three-way main event involving AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, and Christopher Daniels, three of the very best independent wrestlers at that time in the world who had been signed by TNA, went out there, and they had, by what every measure would be described as a five-star match. Just a fantastic match, and it was a big deal at that time because it was a rare pay-per-view main event in TNA then that did not involve any big-name talent or any ex-WWE or WCW guy. There was no Jeff Jarrett or Kevin Nash or Sting or anyone like that. Just three young guys that they could build the company around, and in many ways they kind of did, especially with Joe and with AJ. And 8 years ago this week, on September 10th, 2012, on what was scheduled to be Pat Patterson Appreciation Night in Montreal, even Bret Hart flew in for the show, Bret's first appearance on WWE television in Montreal since the Screwjob. Now, Bret did appear on TV, but the Patterson Appreciation stuff, which I think was going to be an off-air thing when the show was over, that never happened. That never took place because of something more important that happened that night. Jerry Lawler teamed up with Randy Orton on Raw that night to take on CM Punk and Dolph Ziggler. And Dolph Ziggler was dropping elbow after elbow after elbow on Lawler's chest. But they had the match, and I think Lawler and Orton won, and there was nothing really out of the ordinary. You know, Lawler looked fine, everybody looked fine, everything was perfectly normal, and Lawler ended up going back to the announce desk to continue doing commentary for the remainder of the show. And there was a match later on, a tag team match between Team Hell No, Kane and Daniel Bryan, against the Primetime Players. And while the match is going on, Lawler, his voice starts to kind of trail off at one point. And then you hear these weird noises and what sounds like snoring. Sounds like Jerry Lawler has fallen asleep and has started snoring. And Michael Cole, even in recounting the events of that night, says that he thought King was just kind of being funny. He was making fun of the heels during the match and how unexciting they were. And he was kind of pretending to fall asleep. But that's what it sounded like. And I take it that what it really was is because he was deprived of a lot of oxygen. His heart was working so hard. He was trying to breathe and he couldn't breathe. And that's really what the noises were. But he went into cardiac arrest. And he ended up passing out at the announce desk. Michael Cole immediately knew something was wrong. I guess they have maybe a button under the desk that he pushed. He's waving for help. And it was a very scary situation. Lawler was clinically dead for over 20 minutes. They were doing the shock paddles. They were trying to bring him back. And still to this day, he has no memory of wrestling that night or anything that happened. His last memory was being on vacation in Aruba the week before with his girlfriend. When he woke up, he thought that they were either in Aruba or they had just come back. That was the last memory he had. And Dr. Samson, who now works for AEW, he was the one who, you know, his name was brought up last week. He was the one who cleared Matt Hardy to keep wrestling in that match with Sammy Guevara last weekend. He's the one who was on the scene. He was the ringside doctor. He immediately jumped to action. And he's the one who was credited with saving Jerry Lawler's life. Lawler is very lucky. If that had to happen, he's very lucky that it happened in Monday Night Raw and not one of the independent shows that he was still wrestling on every single week. Because if it happened on one of those independent shows, and you know, a lot of those independent shows, they don't have the budget to have a doctor on call or an ambulance waiting. And it wasn't apparent immediately exactly what was going on, or maybe he slumps over and people think he's selling and he's working. If that happens on an independent show, Jerry Lawler ain't here right now. He very likely is not here right now. I actually had the chance to talk to Dr. Samson over WrestleMania 29 weekend. I was with a bunch of my buddies, Noah and Brian and them, and we were walking along and we see Dr. Samson walking the floor at Fan Access. This was in New Jersey. And he's walking the floor and we went over and we grabbed him for a few minutes. We wanted to just kind of talk to him and pick his brain. And this was less than a year after the incident with Lawler. And he told me that he wouldn't even think about clearing Lawler for an in-ring return until at least a full year had passed, which would have been that September. WWE, to my knowledge, still to this very day, and it's been 8 years, and they still have not allowed Lawler to wrestle a match or cleared him to wrestle a match on TV, although he has wrestled plenty of independent matches. He may have even done some stuff in WWE, like some angles and stuff, where there was some physicality involved, but I don't recall, unless I'm just completely blanking out, I don't think Jerry Lawler has wrestled a single match for WWE since the incident. But he loves wrestling. This guy's going to wrestle until he drops. That's just how some of these guys are. And he's still doing indie shots, if not every weekend. He's still doing them every month, especially in the Memphis area and all over. So Lawler is still very active. Lawler was on the Broken Skull sessions with Steve Austin on the WWE Network. They just put that one up, I think, last weekend. And so I watched. It was very good. It was actually very enjoyable. If anyone is looking for another feature on there to take time out to watch, that one runs about an hour and 20 minutes. I think it's worth your time. They spent the majority of the time on there, surprisingly enough, just talking about Memphis. And then obviously the Andy Kaufman angle. But they spent more time talking Memphis than I figured they would. Nothing about his feud with Bret Hart. That was kind of a big thing that they omitted. The one thing I will say is, and it kind of takes you out of it, you know, he was talking about what it was like to, how he ended up getting into the announcing stuff. Because he never wanted to be an announcer. And to this day, Lawler says he does not like announcing. He just doesn't like it. If it were up to him, he wouldn't be doing it. He would be wrestling. He wants to be a wrestler because that's what he is. But he fell into the announcing thing because Randy Savage left and jumped to WCW. Macho Man was doing commentary with Vince McMahon at that time in 94. And he's told this story before, and I just kind of wonder if his memory is faulty, and he just, you say something enough times, you start to believe it to be true. Which I think might be the case with Hogan, and a lot of the stories that Hogan tells. You tell a story enough times, it just becomes fact in people's memories. The way he told the story about what happened with Savage is, they were at Raw, nobody knew where Randy was, everybody's asking around, where's Randy? And then somebody had the TV on, and over on the other channel, there was Macho Man. He popped up on Nitro, and it shocked everybody, and Vince said, King, I need you to kind of sit in and help me out on commentary, and it was only going to be a temporary thing, and of course, it ended up becoming more than just temporary. But that timeline is completely screwed. That timeline makes absolutely no sense. Nitro did not even debut on TNT until the following year. And if I remember, I think Savage's first appearance was on WCW Saturday night. It wasn't even on Nitro. It couldn't have been on Nitro. There was no such thing as Monday Nitro in 1994. So it's possible that he is remembering some variation of that, maybe. But that story is just so wrong. I don't even know where to begin. I will just chalk it up to him having a faulty memory. But I'm sure a lot of people were shocked when they saw that. And that was probably, in Vince McMahon's eyes, a big betrayal, because Randy was almost like family to him. You look around on YouTube, you'll find there's this one clip of one night after a show, after a taping, somebody had a camcorder or whatever, and this would have been 94, and they're videotaping Vince McMahon, Pat Patterson, and Randy Savage walking into a Denny's after a show. You know, probably sitting together and talking about the next show or something. I mean, he was part of that inner circle, and so for him to leave and go to the competition and probably not give them a heads up that he was doing that, which I don't think he was obligated to do, probably was a pretty harsh betrayal in Vince McMahon's eyes. You know, but Randy wanted to wrestle, just like Lawler. He didn't want to do commentary. Vince McMahon thought that his expiration date had passed. It's time for the new generation. And I agree, you always want to be pushing new stars, but you don't think that Randy Savage still being allowed to wrestle and maybe work with guys like Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart couldn't have helped elevate those guys even a little bit more? But that wasn't the role, I guess, that he had in mind for him, and Randy said, adios. And he went to WCW and he made a lot more money and held a lot more world championships. But anyway, that is This Week in Wrestling History. I hope you enjoyed that trip down memory lane. We'll continue to do these in the weeks ahead. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We'll take a few quick questions here from David. David from Dallas. Now that Roman Reigns is a heel with Paul Heyman, do you think when fans return, he will still be booed? Or will he get more cheers now that they got a heel Roman that a lot of them wanted? Personally, I think he'll get booed still because there is no pleasing these people. I don't even know why you would want him. You would want him to be booed. He's a heel. He's supposed to be booed. If the fans like Roman Reigns as a heel, that doesn't mean they're going to cheer him. If anything, they would play along and they would boo him. So that's exactly the reaction that you would want to get. They would want Roman Reigns to be booed. That's why they pipe in boos on TV with these virtual fans. That's the reaction they want. I think he would be booed. I think he would be booed. And that's one of the reasons why they're going to do what they're doing with Jey Uso at Clash of Champions. Katie from Staten Island. After watching SmackDown this week, I have a suggestion as to where Sasha Bailey will lead. I think this has the potential to headline Mania next year, as I do. You heard me talk about that earlier. So I think that if they really want to sell the beating that Sasha got, I say keep her out until the Rumble and have her win it. What do you think? I agree 100%. It's just a matter of, do they want to wait that long? You know, I heard from a couple of different people who think that Sasha should win the Rumble, and I'm all in on that idea. Anthony in Spokane, shout out to him. He had the same thought. He had the same pitch. And I agree. I think Sasha Banks would be the most crowd-pleasing choice that WWE could go with if they were to hold her return off as a Royal Rumble surprise. You know, was it Charlotte Flair, I guess, won the Rumble this year? They went with a heel. I think that you could definitely go with Sasha. And it would get a big reaction, assuming that we have people in the building. And that's a very big question right now. Yeah, I've had people ask me, when do you think that we'll have another stadium WrestleMania? Because we're not getting WrestleMania in SoFi Stadium next year with 50,000 or 60,000 or 70,000 people. If you think so, you're out of your mind. It's not happening. They might attempt to run SoFi Stadium and spread people out and have a lot fewer people. I don't even see that happening. When do I think we're going to get another proper stadium WrestleMania? You want my honest opinion on this? And that's all it is. It's just my opinion. It's just my opinion. When do I think we're going to see another big stadium show like that with 50 or more thousand people for a WWE event like a WrestleMania? Probably not until 2023. I think we're a few years away from that happening. And remember, it doesn't matter what you think. Your opinion is irrelevant. My opinion is irrelevant about whether we think it should be allowed to happen. What it boils down to are the states and the cities and the municipalities and what the rules are at that time as far as COVID goes and whatever measures they have in place. Doesn't matter what you think. Doesn't matter what I think. You want my opinion about what I think is going to happen? I think that it's going to be 2023 before we get another proper stadium WrestleMania. So people better be ready for that. But that doesn't mean they can't have a WrestleMania in a building with people. You know, I would expect certainly by next year, they could probably find a building where they can get people like AEW does, spread out. You'll have at least some people in the building. But this idea that, man, I can't wait until we get back to WrestleMania with 50,000 screaming people and just like it was before, I think you're looking at 2023. I think you're looking long term here. I don't see that being allowed anytime soon. I just don't. And you're not going to another country either. They don't want us. They don't want 50,000 Americans coming on over to, well, it wouldn't be all Americans, obviously, but, you know, congregating in one building like that, it ain't going to happen. So they don't have a lot of options. Unless Vince goes and builds his own stadium, it just doesn't have a lot of options right now. Trevon from St. Louis, did you ever get to go to Action Park as a kid? I feel like you've talked about this on the show before. Have you seen the documentary on HBO Max? I have. I have YouTube TV now. I don't have HBO, but I went for the HBO Max trial so that I could watch it. Yeah, I was at Action Park quite a few times as a kid. Thankfully, I never got any broken bones or anything like that. I didn't know anybody who died, although there were plenty of people who died. But I got injured just like everybody else did. And more than just like little scrapes too. I mean, I got hurt pretty badly on the Alpine slide, which was just this, like, you got to look it up. It's just this like concrete sloping course where you were in like a go-kart type thing. And I mean, it was so narrow. If you were wearing shorts, I mean, your legs were just scraping up against the concrete. The thing about the Alpine slide though, is that it was a lot of fun. I mean, as long as you didn't, like, get a really sharp turn or hit the brake or something on the cart and go flying and crack your skull open, like one person did, it was a lot of fun. So I did the Alpine slide multiple times, scraped the shit out of my legs. I got hurt in the wave pool in a similar way. I got blown back so hard I scraped up my leg. I did a dive once off, see, even I'm guilty of doing dives. Should take my own advice. But I did a dive. They had this, you go to like the edge of this little cliff and people would dive off into the water down below. And I knew basically how to swim, but I wasn't good in deep water. And I didn't know that when I dove off, I was diving into 10 feet deep water. So I do a dive and I'm afraid of heights. So it took a lot for me to do that, but I did the dive and I hit the water. And now I realize, oh shit, this water is deep and it's cold and I am freaking out. So as I'm flailing around and I'm like trying to doggy paddle, there was nobody telling the people up above, okay, you got to wait until this idiot down below moves out of the way. people just would go, the next person would just go ahead and dive because nobody cared. And the people who worked the park, they were all teenagers. They were all teenagers. They weren't like grown adults who were overseeing this. So the next person jumped off, and there was one time when they almost landed on top of me. It would have killed me if they would have landed on top of me. They like just narrowly missed me. Landed right next to me. But that was Action Park. I can't imagine why the park's not open anymore. It's so hard to believe, right? It is a good documentary, though. If you didn't see it, if you have HBO Max, definitely check that out. Mark with a buy, sell, or rent on the best Bret Hart WrestleMania classic. Owen Hart at WrestleMania 10, Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 12, or Stone Cold Steve Austin at WrestleMania 13. He says, to me, all are five-star matches, so choosing is beyond difficult. Well, I'm going to buy on the WrestleMania 13 match, which is one of the greatest matches in the history of that company. I would rent on the match with Owen from WrestleMania 10, and I would sell on the Iron Man match from WrestleMania 12. That's just gonna irritate all the fans of that Iron Man match even more. Not saying it was a bad match. I'm just saying of those three, I have to sell on that one because the other matches were better. And AJ from Tacoma, and we'll end here. What are some of your biggest WrestleMania moments that did not age well? Well, I was thinking about this, and there were two that I scribbled down. Maybe if I really thought about it, I could come up with more. The whole age well thing, I mean, there's not that many of them. There have been some bad ideas and bad match finishes, but they were bad even then. Like, I came up with a list of like 15 different things, but then I said, does this really qualify as like it aged badly? Because like, I'm looking at this list and all this shit was bad even then. But I settled on two. And I settled on the Benoit Eddie moment from WrestleMania 20, which at that time was such a great moment. And you know what? It is still great to go back and watch. It is still, I'm not saying it's not, but it just makes me so sad that I look at that and I think to myself, boy, this didn't age well. Because you can't watch it back and not think about what happened to the both of them. And it just depresses the hell out of me, or what they did. In the case of Benoit. And it just makes me very sad. So for me, that moment did not age well. The other moment that clearly did not age well was from WrestleMania 33, when John Cena proposed marriage to Nikki Bella. And what a special loving moment that was. And now Nikki Bella she's a mom now, and she's with somebody else. And they both seem very happy. I'm very happy for them. I'm happy that Nikki Bella got the kid that she wanted and got the commitment in the relationship that she wanted. Good for her. And John Cena is doing his thing, and he's very happy. And he's got a special someone in his life, and everybody is happy. Everybody wins. But that moment, that moment did not age well. If you have questions for me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I will be using some of these questions in the returning Sound Off inbox, which is coming up. And I know I've said it a lot, but that and RSPW Rewind. I have certain things on my list of things to do this week. There will be a video Sound Off inbox. I've done three of them, all of them from last year. I've not done a single one yet in 2020. We're going to be bringing that back. And I might even be going live for that one, so we could take Super Chat questions as well. But get those questions in. You never know when or where they may be used. TheSolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter @Solemonster there. So if these new features pop up on YouTube, I can link you there and you'll know about them and you can see if I did use your question. And I'm going to be back with you next Sunday, as I am every single weekend. The most reliable thing in wrestling is a weekly Sunday Sound Off from yours truly. You can't always rely on Raw being a good show. You can't always rely on SmackDown being a good show. Even AEW has some off weeks. Other people, podcasters, they take breaks and shit. The most reliable thing in wrestling is a Sunday Sound Off. And so I hope you'll join me for episode 670 next weekend. We're only 30 off from 700 episodes. So join me for 670 next Sunday. And most likely what I am going to guess will be an AEW review live on Wednesday night on YouTube. It could be NXT. But I'm thinking it'll be AEW, most likely. And if you are celebrating the holiday, the upcoming Jewish New Year, I wish you all a happy New Year, a happy and safe week. And I will see you back here next weekend, as always. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
This is the same Lana, by the way, who admitted this week that she and Rusev had sex on top of the tank that Rusev rode out to the ring at WrestleMania 31. Anybody can make a claim like that, really. Look, I was at that WrestleMania. I could sit here and tell you that I had sex on top of that same tank that weekend with a lady friend. And guess what? You'd have no way to prove me wrong.
Oh my God.
So now you're all going to be wondering. Chew on that.
The Sala Monster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Sala Monster on Twitter at Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster Sounds Off.